especially now. Half the world has become too dangerous for you. Let me help you to safety. The tightness slid from his voice, though it took on a raw edge. I beg you, Nynaeve, if anything happened to Elaine, I half wish that Egwene were with you so I could... Scrubbing a hand through his hair, he looked left and right, searching for how to convince her. Uno and Rhaegan held their blades ready to drive through his body, but he did not appear to see them. In the name of the light, Nynaeve, please allow me to do what I can. It was a simple thing that finally tipped the balance in her mind. They were in Gil'dan. Amadisia was the only land that actually made a crime out of a woman being able to channel, and they were on the opposite bank of the river. That left only Galad's oaths as a child of the light to battle against his duty to Elaine. She gave blood the edge in that struggle. Besides, he really was too gorgeous for her to let Uno and Rhaegan kill him. Not that that had anything to do with her decision, of course. "We are with Valen Luka's show," she said at last. He blinked at her, frowned. "Valen Luka's... You mean one of the menageries?" Incredulity and disgust fought in his voice. "What under the light are you doing in company like that? Those who keep such shows are no better than... No matter. If you need coin, I can supply some. Enough to see you in a decent inn." His tone bespoke his certainty that she would do as he wanted. Not a, "Can I help you with a few crowns?" or a, "Would you like me to find a room for you?" He thought they should be in an inn, so into an inn they would go. The man might have observed enough to know she would duck into an alley, but he did not know her at all, it seemed. Besides, there were reasons to stay with Luka. "Do you think there is a room or a hayloft not taken in all of Samara?" she asked, a touch more tartly than intended. "I am certain I can find..." She cut him off. "The last place anyone would look for us is among the shows. The last place anyone but Mogadine would look, at least. You'll agree we should keep from sight as much as possible? If you did find a room, more than likely you'd have to have someone put out of it. A child of the light securing a room so, for two women? That would set tongues wagging and draw eyes like flies to a mitten." He did not like it, grimacing and glaring at Uno and Rhaegan as if it were their fault, but he had enough sense to see sense. "It is no fit place for either of you, but it is probably safer than anywhere inside the city at that. Since you have at least agreed to go to Camelin, I will say no more on it." She kept her face smooth and let him think as he wished. If he thought she had promised what she had not, that was his affair. She had managed to keep him away from the show as much as possible, though. One glimpse of his sister in those spangled white breeches, and the uproar would overshadow any riot Massima could raise. "You will have to stay clear of the menagerie, mind, until you find a ship anyway. Then come to the performers' wagons at nightfall and ask for Nana." He liked that even less, if possible, but she forestalled him firmly. "I've not seen a single child of the light near any of the shows. If you visit one, don't you think people will notice and ask why?" His smile was still gorgeous, but it showed too many teeth. "You have an answer for everything, it seems. Do you have any objection to my escorting you back there, at least?" "I most certainly do. There will be rumors as it is. 100 people must have noticed us talking here." She could no longer see the street past the three men, yet she had no doubt passers-by were still glancing into the alley, and Uno and Rhaegan had not resheathed their swords. "But if you accompany me, we'll be seen by 10 times as many." His wince was half rueful, half mirthful. "An answer for everything," he muttered. "But you have the right of it." Clearly he wished she did not. "Hear me, Shinarans," he said, turning his head, and suddenly his voice was steel. "I am Galadredid Domadred, and this woman is under my protection. As for her companion, I would count it small loss to die in order to save her the smallest harm. If you allow either to come to that smallest harm, I will find you both and kill you." Ignoring the sudden dangerous blankness of their faces as completely as he did their swords, he swung his eyes back to her. "I suppose you still will not tell me where Egwene is." "All you need know is that she is far from here." Folding her arms beneath her breasts, she could feel her heart beating through her ribs. Was she making a dangerous mistake because of a pretty face? And safer than any action of yours can make her. He looked as if he did not believe her, but he made no more of it. With luck, I will find a vessel in a day or two. Until then, stay close to this Valen Luka's show. Stay low and avoid notice, as much as you can with your hair that color. And tell Elaine not to run away from me again. The light shone on you to let me find you still in one piece, and it will have to shine twice as brightly to keep you from harm if you try herring off across Gildon. This prophet's blasphemous ruffians are everywhere, without respect for law or persons, and that does not count brigands taking advantage of disorder. Samara itself is a wasp nest, but if you will sit quietly and convince my headstrong sister to do the same, I will find a way to get you out of it before you are stung. It was an effort to keep her mouth shut. Taking what she told him and making it an injunction to her? Next thing, the man would want to pack her and Elaine in wool and sit them on a shelf. Wouldn't it be best if someone did? A tiny voice asked. Haven't you caused enough trouble going your own way? She told the voice to be quiet. It did not listen, but began listing disasters and near-disasters sprung from her own stubbornness. Apparently taking her silence for acquiescence, he turned away from her and stopped. Regan and Uno had moved to block his way to the street, glancing at her with that strange, deceptive calm men so often adopted when they were a hair's breadth from sudden violence. The air seemed to crackle until she motioned hurriedly. The Shinarans lowered their blades and stood aside, and Galad took his hands from his sword, brushed past them, and melded into the crowd without a backward glance. Nynaeve gave Uno and Regan each a good glare before stalking off in the opposite direction. There she had had everything arranged properly, and they had to nearly ruin it all. Men always seemed to think violence could solve anything. If she had had a stout stick, she would have thumped all three of them about the shoulders until they saw reason. The Shinarans seemed to see a little of it now. They caught up to her, swords scabbarded on their backs once more, and followed without a word, even when she twice took a wrong turn and had to double back. It was especially well for them that they kept silent then. She had had enough of holding her tongue. First Massima, and then Galad. All she wanted was a wafer-thin excuse to tell someone exactly what she thought. Especially that little voice in her head, pushed back to an insect buzz now, but refusing to be quiet. By the time they were out of Samara and on that dirt cart track with its sparse traffic, the voice refused to be denied. She worried over Rand's arrogance, but hers had brought herself and others as near calamity as made no never mind. For Birgitta, perhaps it was well over the line, even if she was alive. The best thing was for Nynaeve not to confront them again, not the Black Adja and not Mogadine, not until someone who knew what they were doing could decide what should be done. Protest welled up, but she stamped on it as firmly as she ever had on Tom or Juelin. She would go to Salidar and hand the matter over to the Blues. That was how it would be. She was set on it. "Have you eaten something that disagrees with you?" Rhaegon said. "Your mouth is twisted as if you had chewed a ripe duckberry." She gave him a look that snapped his teeth shut and stalked on. The two Shinarans kept pace to either side. What was she going to do with them? That she should put them to some use was never in doubt. Their appearance was too providential to throw away. For one thing, two additional pairs of eyes—well, three eyes, anyway— She was going to learn to look at that patch without swallowing if it killed her. More eyes hunting for a ship might mean finding one sooner. All very well if Massima or Galad found a vessel first, but she did not want either to know more of her doings than she had to allow. There was no telling what either might do. "Are you following me because Massima told you to look after me?" she demanded. "Or because Galad did?"
"What flaming difference does it make?" Uno muttered. "If the Lord Dragon has summoned you, you bloody well—"
He cut off, frowning, as she raised one finger. Rhaegon eyed it as if it were a weapon. "Do you mean to help Elaine and me reach Rand?"
"We've nothing better to do," Rhaegon said dryly. "As it is, we'll not see Shinar again until we are gray and toothless. We might as well ride with you to Tyr or wherever he is."
She had not considered that, but it made sense.
two more to help Tom and Jewel in with chores and standing guard. No need to let them know how long that might take, or how many stops and detours could lie along the way. The Blues in Salidar might not let any of them go further. Once they reached Aes Sedai, they would be only accepted again. Stop thinking about it. You are going to do it. The crowd waiting in front of Luca's garish sign appeared no smaller than it had before. A stream of people trickled into the meadow to join the throng as another stream meandered out, exclaiming over what they had seen. Now and again the boar horses were visible, rearing above the canvas wall, to oohs and ahs from those waiting to get in. Sarandon was putting them through their paces again. The Shanchan woman always saw that the Sredit got plenty of rest. She was very firm about that, whatever Luca wanted. Men did do as they were told when you left no doubt that anything else was inconceivable. Usually they did. Short of the well-trampled brown grass, Nynaeve stopped and turned to face the two Shinarans. She kept her face calm, but they looked suitably wary, though in Uno's case, regrettably, that involved fiddling with his eye patch in a queasy-making way. The folk heading to or from the show paid no heed to them. "Then it will not be because of Massima or Galad," she said firmly. "If you are going to travel with me, you will do as I say, else you can go your own way, for I'll have none of you." Of course they had to exchange glances before nodding acceptance. "If that's how it flaming has to be," Uno growled, "then well enough. If you don't have somebody to bloody well look after you, you'll never flaming live to reach the Lord Dragon. Some sheep-gutted farmer will have you for breakfast because of your tongue." Rhaegun gave him a guarded look that said he agreed with every word, but strongly doubted Uno's wisdom in voicing them. Rhaegun, it seemed, had the makings of a wise man in him. If they accepted her terms, it did not really matter why. For now, there would be plenty of time later to set them straight. "I don't doubt the others will agree, too," Rhaegun said. "Others?" she said, blinking. "You mean there are more than the two of you? How many?" "There are only 15 of us altogether now. I don't think Bartu or Nengar will come." "Sniffing after the bloody prophet," Uno turned his head and spat copiously. "Only 15. Sar went over that bloody cliff in the mountains, and Mendao had to get himself into a flaming duel with 3 hunters for the horn, and—" Nynaeve was too busy stopping herself from gaping to listen. 15. She could not help toting up in her head what it would cost to feed 15 men. Even when they were not particularly hungry, Tom or Jewel in either one ate more than Elaine and her combined. Light. On the other hand, with 15 Shinaran soldiers, there was no need to wait for a ship. A riverboat was certainly the fastest way to travel. She remembered what she had heard of Salidar now, a river town, or close by. A boat could take them right to it. Yet a Shinaran escort would make their wagon just as safe, from white cloaks or bandits or followers of the Prophet, but much slower. And a lone wagon heading away from Samara with such an escort would certainly stand out. A signpost for Mogadin or the Black Aja. "I will let the Blues deal with them, and that is that." "What is wrong?" Rhaegun asked, and Uno added apologetically, "I shouldn't have mentioned how Sakaru died." Sakaru? That must have been after she stopped listening. "I don't spend much time around around ladies. I forget you have delicate stomachs." If he did not stop tugging in that eye patch, he was going to find out how delicate her stomach was. The number changed nothing. If 2 Shinarans were good, 15 were wonderful. Her own private army. No need to worry about white cloaks or brigands or riots, or whether she had made a mistake about Galad. How many hams could 15 men eat every day? A firm voice. "Right then. Every night just after dark, one of you, one, mind, will come here and ask for Nana. That's the name I am known by." She had no reason for the order except to put them in the habit of doing what she told them. "Elaine goes by Morellin, but you ask for Nana. If you need coin, come to me, not Massima." She had to suppress a wince as the words left her mouth. There was still gold in the wagon's stove, but Luca had not demanded his 100 gold crowns yet, and he would. There was always the jewelry, if need be, though. She had to be sure they were weaned away from Massima. Aside from that, none of you are to come near me or the show. Without that, they would likely set a guard or some such idiocy. Not unless a riverboat arrives. In that case, you come running on the instant. Do you understand me?
No,
Uno muttered. Why do we flaming have to keep away? His head jerked back, as her admonitory finger almost touched his nose. Do you remember what I said about your language? She had to make herself give him a level look. That glaring red eye patch made her stomach do flips. Unless you do remember, you will learn why men in the Two Rivers have decent tongues in their mouths. She watched him turn that over in his mind. He did not know what her connection with the White Tower was, only that it existed. She might be an agent of the Tower, or Tower trained, or even Aes Sedai, though one not long to the shawl, and the threat was vague enough for him to put his own worst interpretation to it. She had known that technique long before hearing Julin mention it to Elaine. When it appeared the idea had taken hold, and before he could ask any questions, she lowered her hand. You will stay away for the same reason Galad does, so as not to draw attention. For the rest, you will do it because I say so. If I must explain my every decision to you, I'll have time for nothing else, so you must make the best of it. That was a suitably Aes Sedai comment. Besides, they had no choice if they intended to help her reach Rand, as they thought, which meant they had no choice. All in all, she was feeling quite satisfied with herself as she shooed them off back toward Samara and strode past the waiting crowd and under the sign bearing Valen Luca's name. To her surprise, there was an addition to the show. On a new platform not far from the entry, a woman in gauzy yellow trousers was standing on her head, arms outstretched to either side with a pair of white doves on each hand. No, not on her head. The woman was gripping some sort of wooden frame in her teeth and balancing on that. As Nynaeve watched, aghast, the peculiar acrobat lowered her hands to the platform for a moment while bending herself double until she seemed to be sitting on her own head. Even that was not enough. Her legs curved down in front of her, then impossibly back up under her arms, whereupon she transferred the doves to the upturned soles of her feet, now the highest part of the contorted ball she had knotted herself into. The onlookers gasped and applauded, but the sight made Nynaeve shiver. It was all too good a reminder of what Mugadine had done to her. "That isn't why I mean to hand her over to the Blues," she told herself. "I just do not want to cause calamity again." That was true, but she was also afraid that the next time she would not escape so easily or so lightly. She would not have admitted that to another soul. She did not like admitting it to herself. Giving the contortionist one last puzzled glance, she could not begin to puzzle out what the woman had twisted herself into now, she turned away, and started as Elaine and Birgitta suddenly appeared at her side out of the milling crowd. Elaine had a cloak decently covering her white coat and breeches. Birgitta was all but flaunting her low-necked red gown. No, there was no all but to it. She stood even straighter than usual, and had tossed back her braid to remove even its minimal covering. Nynaeve fingered the knot of her shawl at her waist, wishing every glance at Birgitta did not remind her how much she herself would be showing once the gray wool came off. The other woman's quiver hung at her belt, and she carried the bow Luca had found for her. Surely the day was too late for her to go through with the shooting. A glance at the sky told Nynaeve she was wrong. Despite everything that had happened, the sun still stood well above the horizon. Shadows stretched long, but not long enough to dissuade Birgitta, she suspected. In an attempt to cover checking the sun, she nodded toward the woman in the gauzy trousers, who had now begun to twist herself into something that Nynaeve knew was impossible, while still balancing on her teeth. Where did she come from? Luca hired her, Birgitta answered calmly. He bought some leopards as well. Her name is Muellen. If Birgitta was all self-possessed coolness, Elaine very nearly quivered with emotion. Where did she come from? She spluttered. She came from a show that a mob nearly destroyed. I heard about that, Nynaeve said. But that isn't what's important. Not important! Elaine rolled her eyes to the heavens as if for guidance. Did you also hear why? I don't know whether it was White Cloaks or this prophet, but somebody whipped up that mob because they thought... She glanced around without slowing and lowered her voice. None of the crowd had stopped, but every passerby stared at two obvious performers standing. That a woman in the show might wear a shawl. She emphasized the last word significantly. Fools to think she'd be with a traveling menagerie, but then you and I are. And you go dashing into the city without a word to anyone. We've heard everything from a bald-headed man carrying you off over his shoulder to you kissing a Shinaran and traipsing away with him arm in arm. Nynaeve was still gaping when Birgitta added, Luca was upset, whatever the tale. He said, she cleared her throat and made her voice deep.
So she likes rough men, does she? Well, I can be as rough as a winter cob.
And off he set, leading two lads with shoulders like Skandin quarrymen to fetch you back. Tom Merrillin and Julin Sandar went as well, in not much better temper. That did not improve Luca's, but they were all so upset over you it left no room for anger at each other. For a moment Nynaeve stared in confusion. She liked rough men? What could he possibly mean by— Slowly it sank in, and she groaned. Oh, that is just what I need. And Tom and Julin running around Samara, the light knew what trouble they could get into. I still want to know what you thought you were doing, Elaine said, but we are wasting time here. Nynaeve let them start her off through the crowd, one to either side, but even with the news of Luca and the others, she felt satisfied with her day's work. We should be out of here in a day or two, with luck. If Galad doesn't find us a boat, Massima will. It turns out he is the prophet. You remember Massima, Elaine, that sour-faced Shinaran we saw. Realizing that Elaine had stopped, Nynaeve paused for her to catch up again. Galad? The younger woman said disbelievingly, forgetting to hold her cloak closed. You spoke to Galad? And the prophet? You must have, or how would they be trying to find a vessel? Did you have tea with them, or did you just meet them in a common room, where the bald-headed man carried you, no doubt? Maybe the King of Gildan was there, too. Would you please convince me I am dreaming so I can wake up?
Get a grip on yourself, Nynaeve said firmly. It is a queen now, not a king, and yes, she was. And he wasn't bald, he had a topknot. The Shinaran, I mean, not the prophet. He's as bald as—
She glared at Birgitta until the woman stopped snickering. The glower slipped a little when Nynaeve remembered who she was glowering at and what she had done to her. But if the woman had not smoothed her features, they might have found out whether she could bring herself to slap Birgitta cross-eyed. They began walking again, and she said as levelly as she could manage, This is what happened. I saw Uno, one of the Shinarans who was at Falma, watching you highwalk Elaine. He doesn't think any better of the daughter heir of Andor showing her legs than I do, by the way. In any case, Moiraine sent them here after Falma, but... She related everything quickly as they made their way through the crowd, riding roughshod over Elaine's increasingly incredulous exclamations, answering their questions in as few words as possible. Despite a quick interest in the shifts of the Gildanin throne, Elaine concentrated on exactly what Galad had said, and why Nynaeve had been fool enough to approach the prophet, whoever he was. That word, fool, popped up often enough to make Nynaeve keep a tight leash on her temper. She might doubt whether she could slap Birgitta, but Elaine had no such protection, daughter heir or not. A few more repetitions and the girl would discover it. Birgitta was more interested in Massima's intentions on the one hand, and the Shinarans on the other. It seemed she had encountered borderlanders in previous lives, though their nations had had different names, and thought well of them, by and large. She said little, really, but she appeared to approve of holding on to the Shinarans. Nynaeve expected the news about Salidar to startle them, or excite them, or anything but what it did. Birgitta took it as matter-of-factly as if she had said they would eat supper with Tom and Julin that night. Plainly, she meant to go where Elaine did, and all else mattered little. Elaine looked doubtful.
Doubtful? Are you certain? You have tried so hard to remember, and...
Well, it seems awfully fortuitous that Galad should just happen to mention it to you.
Nynaeve glowered. Of course I am certain. Coincidences do happen. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, as you may have heard. I remember now that he mentioned it in Sienda, too, but I was so concerned over you being concerned about him that I didn't... She cut off short. They had arrived at a long, narrow area near the north wall marked off by ropes. At one end stood something like a segment of wooden fence, 2 paces wide and 2 tall. People lined the ropes 4 deep, with children crouching down in front or holding a father's leg or a mother's skirts. A buzz rose as the 3 women appeared. Nynaeve would have stopped dead, but Brigitta had her by the arm, and it was walk or be dragged.
"I thought we were going to the wagon," she said faintly.
Busy with talking, she had paid too little attention to where they were going. "Not unless you want to see me shoot in the dark," Brigitta replied. She sounded all too willing to give it a try. Nynaeve wished she could have made some other comment than a squeak. The bit of fence filled her vision as they progressed down the open space, to the exclusion of the onlookers. Even their increasing murmurs sounded distant. The fence looked a mile from where Brigitta would stand.
"Are you certain that he said he swore by our mother?" Elaine demanded sourly. Acknowledging Galad as her brother even that far was unpleasant for her.
"What? Yes, I said so, didn't I? Listen, if Lucai is in the city, he would not know whether we did this or not until it was too late to—"
Nynaeve knew she was babbling, but she could not seem to stop her tongue. Somehow she had never realized how far 100 paces really was. In the 2 rivers, grown men always shot targets at twice that, but then none of those targets had ever been her.
"I mean, it already is very late. The shadows, the glare. We really should do this in the morning, when the light is—"
"If he swore by her," Elaine broke in as if she had not been listening, "then he will hold to it no matter what. He would sooner break an oath on his hope of salvation and rebirth than that. I know we can trust him." She did not sound as if she particularly liked it, though.
"The light is just fine," Brigitta said, a hint of amusement in her calm voice. "I might try it blindfolded. This lot will want it to look difficult, I think."
Nynaeve opened her mouth, but nothing came out. This time she would have settled for a squeak. Brigitta was only making a bad joke. She had to be joking. They positioned her with her back against the rough wooden fence, and Elaine began tugging at the knot in the shawl as Brigitta turned back the way they had come, drawing an arrow from her quiver.
"You really did something foolish this time," Elaine muttered. "We can trust Galad's oath, I'm sure, but you could not know what he might do beforehand, and to approach the prophet."
She jerked the shawl from Nynaeve's shoulders roughly.
"You could have had no idea whatsoever what he might do. You worried everybody and risked everything."
"I know," Nynaeve managed to get out. The sun was in her eyes. She could no longer see Brigitta at all. But Brigitta could see her. Of course she could. That was the important thing. Elaine looked at her suspiciously.
"You know?"
"I know I risked everything. I should have talked with you, asked you. I know I've been a fool. I should not be allowed outside without a keeper."
It all came in a breathless rush. Brigitta must be able to see her. Suspicion became concern.
"Are you all right? If you really do not want to do this—" The woman thought she was afraid.
Nynaeve could not, would not, allow that. She forced a smile, hoped her eyes were not too wide. Her face felt tight.
"Of course I want to. I'm looking forward to it, actually."
Elaine gave her a dubious frown, but nodded at last.
"You are sure about Salidar?"
She did not wait for an answer, but hurried off to one side, folding the shawl. For some reason, Nynaeve could not work up a proper indignation over the question, or Elaine not waiting. Her breath was coming so fast that she was dimly aware that she might come right out of the dress's low neck, yet even that thought could not catch her. The sun filled her view. Had she squinted, she might have been able to make out Brigitta after a fashion, but her eyes had a will of their own, increasingly widening. There was nothing she could do now. It was a punishment for taking foolish risks. She could manage only the tiniest peek over being punished after working everything out so well. And Elaine did not even believe her about Salidar. She would have to take it stoically. She would— Seemingly out of nowhere, an arrow chunked into the wood, vibrating against her right wrist, and stoic resolve broke with a low wail. It was all she could do to keep her knees straight. A second arrow brushed the other wrist, producing a slightly higher pitch to her yelp. She could as soon stop Brigitta's shafts as silence herself. Arrow by arrow, the yelps rose higher, and it seemed to her almost as if the crowd was cheering her cries. The louder she shrieked, the louder they cheered and applauded. By the time she was outlined from knees to head, the applause was thunderous. In truth, she felt some irritation at the finish, when the crowd all rushed to throng around Brigitta, leaving her standing there staring at the fletchings around her. Some still quivered. She still quivered. Pushing away, she scurried off toward the wagons as quickly as she could before anyone noticed how much her legs were wobbling. Not that anyone was paying any attention to her. All she had done was stand there and pray Brigitta did not sneeze or get an itch. And tomorrow she would have to go through it again. That or let Elaine, and worse, Brigitta, know she could not face it. When Uno came that night asking after Nana, she told him in no uncertain terms to prod Massima as much as he dared, and to find Galad and tell him he must find a boat quickly, whatever it required. Then she took to her bed without eating, and tried to make herself believe that she could convince Elaine and Brigitta that she was too ill to stand against that wall. Only she was all too certain they would know exactly what her illness was. That even Brigitta would likely be all sympathy just made it worse. One of those fool men had to find a riverboat.
Chapter 41. The Craft of Kin Torvere. One hand on his sword hilt, the other holding the green and white tasseled length of the Shanchan sword, Rand ignored the others on the sparsely treed hilltop for the moment, while he studied the three camps spread out below in the mid-morning sun. Three distinct camps, and that was the rub. They were all the Kyrian and Tyran forces at his disposal. Every man else who could use sword or spear was penned in the city, or the light alone knew where. The Aiel had rounded up refugees in hordes between the Jengai Pass and here, and a few had even straggled in on their own, lured by rumors that these Aiel, at least, were not killing everyone in sight, or else too dispirited to care so long as they had a meal before dying. Too many thought they would die, at the hands of the Aiel, or the dragon reborn, or in the last battle, which they seemed to think was shaping up for any day now. A goodly number altogether, but farmers and craftsmen and shopkeepers for the most part. Some knew how to use bow or sling to fetch a rabbit, but there was not a soldier in the lot and no time to teach them. The city of Kyrian itself lay little more than 5 miles to the west, some of the fabled topless towers of Kyrian visible above the intervening forest. The city sprawled across hills hard by the river Alguenya, encircled by Culloden's Shido and those who had joined him. One haphazard set of tents and cook fires in the long, shallow valley below Rand held some 800 Tyrans, armored men. Nearly half were defenders of the stone in burnished breastplates and rimmed helmets, their plump coat sleeves striped black and gold. The rest were levies from a double handful of lords whose banners and pennants made a circle in the camp's center, around the silver crescent and stars of the High Lord Wyroman. Guards stood thickly along their picket lines, as if they expected a raid against the horses any minute. 300 paces away, the second camp guarded their horses as tightly. The animals were a mixed lot, few approaching the fine arched neck stock of Tyr, and some former plow and cart horses were tied along those ropes, or Rand missed his guess. The Kyrianen numbered perhaps 100 more than the Tyrans, but their tents were fewer and most often patched, and their banners and khan represented some 70-odd lords. Few Kyrianen nobles still had many retainers, and the army had broken apart early in the civil war. The last gathering lay another 500 paces along, full of Kyrianen for the most part, yet well and truly separated from the others by more than distance. Larger than the other pair combined, this camp held few tents or horses. It displayed no banners, and only the officers wore khan. The small pennants on their backs, in solid colors, meant to pick them out for their men rather than signify a house. Infantry might be necessary, but rare was the Lord of Tyr or Cairhien, either one, who would admit it. Certainly none would agree to actually lead such. It was the most orderly of the camps, though. The cook fires in neat rows, the long pikes stacked upright where they could be seized in a moment, and clusters of archers or crossbowmen dotted along the lines. According to Lan, discipline kept men alive in battle, but infantry were more likely to know it and believe it than cavalry. The three groups were supposedly together under the same command. The High Lord Wyroman had brought them in from the south late the day before. But the two camps of horsemen watched each other nearly as warily as they did the Aiel on the surrounding hills. The Tyrans with a dose of contempt that the Cairhienin echoed in ignoring the third, which in turn eyed the others sullenly. Rand's followers, his allies, and as ready to fight each other as anyone else. Still pretending to study the camps, Rand examined Wyroman, helmetless and iron-spined straight nearby. Two younger men, minor Tyran lords, hung at the High Lord's heels, dark beards trimmed and oiled in perfect imitation of Wyroman's, except that his was streaked with gray, and their breastplates, worn over brightly striped coats, bore gold work only a touch less ornate than his. Aloof, apart from everyone else on the hilltop, yet close to Rand, they could have been waiting for some martial ceremony at a royal court, except for the sweat rolling down their faces. They ignored that as well, though. The High Lord's sigil lacked only a few stars to duplicate Lanfear's, but the long-nosed fellow was not her in disguise, with his mainly gray hair oiled like his beard and combed in a vain attempt to hide its thinness. He had been coming north with reinforcements from Tyr when he heard that Aiel were attacking the city of Cairhien itself. Instead of turning back or sitting still, he continued north as hard as his horses could stand, gathering what forces he found along the way. That was the good news of Wyroman. The bad was that he had fully expected to dispel the Shido around Cairhien with what he had brought. He still did, and he was none too happy that Rand would not let him be about it, or that he was surrounded by Aiel. One Aiel was no different from another to Wyroman, to the others too, for that matter. One of the young lords pointedly sniffed a scented silk handkerchief whenever he looked at an Aiel. Rand wondered how long the fellow would survive, and what Rand would have to do about it when he died. Wyroman noticed Rand watching and cleared his throat.
"My lord dragon," he began in a gravelly bark, "one good charge will scatter them like quail."
He slapped his gauntlets against his palm loudly.
"Foot never stands up to horse. I will send in the Cairhien to flush them, then follow with my—"
Rand cut him off. Could the man count at all? Did the number of Aiel he could see here give him no clue to how many might be around the city? It did not matter. Rand had heard as much of this as he could stomach.
"You are certain of the news you bring from Tyr?"
Wyroman blinked.
"News, my lord dragon? What? Oh, that. Burn my soul, there's nothing to that. Ilianar pirates often try to raid along the coast."
They were more than trying by what the man had said when he arrived.
"And the attacks on the plains of Morador? Do they often do that as well?"
"Why, burn my soul, those are just brigands."
It was more statement of fact than protest.
"Perhaps not Ilianars at all, but certainly not soldiers. The jumble those Ilianars make of things, who can say whether king or assemblage or council of nine has the whip hand on any given day? Yet if they do decide to move, it will be armies striking at Tyr under the golden bees, not raiders burning merchants' wagons in border farms. You can mark me on that."
"If you wish it," Rand replied, as politely as he could. Whatever power the Assemblage, or the Council of Nine, or Matin Stepaneost and Balgar had, it was what Samael chose to leave them. But relatively few knew that the Forsaken were loose already. Some who should know refused to believe, or ignored it, as if that would make the Forsaken go away, or seemed to think that if it had to happen, it would be in some vague and preferably distant future.
There was no point in trying to convince Wireman, whichever group he belonged in. The man's belief or disbelief changed nothing. The High Lord scowled at the hollow between the hills, more specifically, at the two Karienin camps.
With no proper rule here as yet, who can say what riffraff has drifted south?
Grimacing, he slapped his gauntlets even harder before turning back to Rand.
Well, we will bring them to heel soon enough for you, my lord dragon. If you will only give the order, I can drive.
Rand brushed past him, not listening, though Wireman followed, still asking authority to attack, the other two trailing him like heel hounds. The man was a stone-blind fool. They were not alone, of course. The hilltop was crowded, really. Sulin had 100 Fardarai's Mai arrayed around the peak, for one thing, every last one looking even more ready to don her veil than Aiel usually did. It was not only the nearness of the Shido that had Sulin on edge. In mockery of Ren's contempt for the suspicions in the camps below, Anila and two maidens were never far from Wireman and his lordlings. And the closer they stood to Rand, the more the three maidens looked about to don veils. Not far off, Avienda stood talking with a dozen or more wise ones, shawls looped over their elbows, all but she decked in bracelets and necklaces. Surprisingly, it was a bony white-haired woman, even older than Bear, who seemed to be taking the lead. Rand would have expected Amis or Bear, but even they shut up as soon as Soralea spoke. Melaine was with Bale, halfway between the other wise ones and the other clan chiefs. She kept adjusting the coat of Bale's cut and sore, as if he did not know how to dress himself, and he had the patient look of a man reminding himself of all the reasons he had married. It might be personal, but Rand suspected the wise ones were trying to influence the chiefs again. If that was the case, he would learn the particulars soon enough. It was Avienda who held Rand's eye, though. She smiled at him briefly before returning to listening to Soralea. A friendly smile, but no more. That was something, he supposed. She had not lashed out at him once since what had happened between them, and if she sometimes made an acid comment, it was no sharper than what he might have expected from Egwene. Except the one time he had brought up marriage again. Then she had scorched his ears so thoroughly that he had left it alone thereafter. But friendly was as far as it went, though she was sometimes careless now about undressing in front of him at night. She still insisted on sleeping no more than 3 paces from him. The maidens, at any rate, seemed sure that there was a lot less than 3 paces between their blankets, and he kept expecting that certainty to spread, but so far it had not. Egwene would come down on him like a falling tree if she even suspected something like that. It was easy enough for her to talk of Elaine, but he could not even puzzle out Avienda, and she was right there in front of him. All in all, he was tenser than ever when he as much as looked at Avienda, but she seemed more relaxed than he had ever seen her. Somehow or other, that seemed the opposite of how it should be. It all seemed topsy-turvy with her. But then, Min was the only woman who had not made him feel as if he were standing on his head half the time. Sighing, he walked on, still not listening to Wireman. One day he was going to understand women. When he had the time to apply to it, he suspected a lifetime would not be enough, though. The clan chiefs had their own gathering, of sept chiefs and representatives from the societies. Rand recognized some of them. Dark Hyrn, chief of the Jindo Tardad, and Mangan, who gave him a companionable nod, and the Tyrans, a contemptuous grimace. Spear-slender Juranai, leader of the Aethon Dor, the Red Shields, on this expedition, despite a few streaks of white in his pale brown hair, and Roydan, thick-shouldered and gray, who led Shamad Kanda, the Thunderwalkers. Those four had sometimes joined him in practicing the Aiel way of fighting without weapons since leaving the Jangai Pass. "Do you want to go hunting today?" Mangan asked as Rand passed, and Rand looked at him in surprise. "Hunting? There is not much to give sport, but we could try catching sheep in a sack." The wry glance Mangan darted at the Tyrans left little doubt what sheep he meant, though Wireman and the others did not see. Or affected not to. The lordling with the perfumed handkerchief sniffed it again. Another time, maybe, Ran replied, shaking his head. He thought he could have been friends with any of the four, but especially Mangan, who had a sense of humor much like Matt's. If he had no time to study women, he certainly had no time for making new friends. Little time for old friends, for that matter. Matt worried him. On the highest part of the hill, a heavy framework tower of logs thrust above the treetops, the wide platform at the top 20 spans or more above the ground. The Aiel knew nothing about working with wood on that scale, but there had been plenty among the Kyrianan refugees who did. Moiraine was waiting at the base of the first slanting ladder with Lan and Egwene. Egwene had been getting a good bit of sun. She really could have passed for Aiel except for her dark eyes. A short Aiel. He scanned her face quickly, but detected nothing except tiredness. Amis and the others must be working her too hard with her training. She would not thank him for interceding, though. "Have you decided?" Rand asked, stopping. Wireman fell silent at last. Egwene hesitated, but Rand noted that she did not look at Moiraine before nodding.
"I will do what I can."
Her reluctance bothered him. He had not asked Moiraine. She could not use the One Power as a weapon against the Shido, not unless they threatened her, or he managed to convince her they were all dark friends. But Egwene had not taken the three oaths, and he had been sure she would see the necessity. Instead, she had gone white-faced when he suggested it, and had avoided him for 3 days until now. At least she had agreed. Whatever made the fight shorter against the Shido must be for the good. Moraine's face never changed, though he had no doubt what she thought. Those smooth Aes Sedai features, those Aes Sedai eyes, could register icy disapproval without altering a jot. Thrusting the piece of spear through his belt, he put foot to the first rung, and Moiraine spoke.
"Why are you wearing a sword again?"
The last question he would have expected. "Why shouldn't I?" he muttered, and scrambled upward. Not a good answer, but she had caught him off balance. The half-healed wound in his side tugged as he climbed, not quite hurting, but seeming about to break open just the same. He paid it no mind. It often felt that way when he exerted himself. Ruark and the other clan chiefs came after him, Bale leaving the lane last of all, but thankfully Wireman and his two toadies remained on the ground. The High Lord knew what was to be done. He needed and wanted no more information. Feeling Moraine's eyes following him, Rand glanced down. Not Moiraine. It was Egwene watching him climb, her face so close to Aes Sedai that he could not have slid a hair through the difference. Moiraine had her head together with Lan's. He hoped Egwene was not going to change her mind. On the broad platform at the top, two short, sweating young men in shirt sleeves were setting a brass-bound wooden tube, 3 paces long and bigger around than either's arm, on a pivoting frame fastened to the railing. An identical tube already sat a few paces away, where it had been almost since the tower was completed the day before. A third coatless man wiped his bald head with a striped kerchief while he growled at them.
"Easy with it! Easy, I said! You motherless weasels, knock a lens out of alignment, and I will knock your brainless heads backward to front! Fasten it tight, Jewel. Tight! If it falls while the Lord Dragon is looking through it, you both had better jump after it. Not just for him. You break my work, and you will wish you had broken your fool skulls."
Joel and the other fellow, Kale, worked on, quickly but not very visibly perturbed. They had had years to grow used to Kin Torvir's way of talking. It had been finding a craftsman who made lenses and looking-glasses, and his two apprentices, among the refugees that had first given Rand the idea for this tower. At first, none of the three noticed they were not alone. The clan chiefs climbed on silent feet, and Torvir's harangue was enough to cover the sound of Rand's boots. Rand himself was startled when Lan's head popped through the open trap after Bale. Boots or no, the water made no more noise than the Aiel. Even Han stood a head taller than the Kyrianan. When they finally did see the new arrivals, the two apprentices gave wide-eyed starts as if they had never seen an Aiel before, then bent themselves in half, bowing to Rand, and stayed that way. The lensmaker jerked almost as much at the sight of the Aiel, but made a more restrained bow, wiping his head again in the middle of it.
"Told you I would have the second finished today, my lord dragon."
Tovir managed to get respect into his tone without making his voice one bit less gruff.
"A wonderful thought, this tower. I would never have conceived it, but once you started asking how far you could see with a looking-glass, give me time, and I will make you one to see Camelon from here, if the tower is built high enough," he added judiciously. "There are limits."
"What you've done already is more than enough, Master Tovir." More than Rand had hoped for, certainly. He had already had a look through the first looking-glass. Joel and Kale were still bent at right angles, heads down.
"Perhaps you had best take your apprentices below," Rand said, "so we don't get crowded."
There was room for four times as many, but Tovir immediately poked Kale's shoulder with a thick finger.
"Come along, you ham-fisted stable boys. We are in the Lord Dragon's way."
The apprentices barely straightened enough to follow him, gazing round-eyed at Rand even more than at the Aiel as they vanished down the ladder. Kale was a year older than he, Joel, too. Both had been born in towns bigger than he had imagined before leaving the Two Rivers. Had visited Kyrian and seen the king in the Ammerlin seat, if at a distance, while he was still tending sheep. Very likely they still knew more of the world than he in some ways. Shaking his head, he bent to the new looking-glass. Kyrian leaped into view. The forests, never particularly thick to one used to Two Rivers woods, stopped completely well short of the city, of course. High gray square-towered walls in a perfect square against the river mocked the hill's flowing curves. Within, more towers rose in precise pattern, marking the points of a grid some 20 times as high as the walls or more, yet all surrounded by scaffolding. The legendary topless towers were still being rebuilt after their burning in the Aiel War. When last he had seen the city, another city had surrounded it from riverbank to riverbank. Forgate, a rabbit warren as raucous as Kyrian was solemn, all in wood. Now only a wide stretch of ash and charred timbers bordered the walls. How that fire had been kept from spreading into Kyrian itself, he could not understand. Banners decked every tower in the city, too distant to make out clearly, but scouts had described them to him. Half bore the crescents of Tyr, the other half, perhaps not surprisingly, duplicated the dragon banner he had left flying over the stone of Tyr. Not one bore the rising sun of Kyrian. Moving the looking-glass only a little swept the city from his sight. On the far side of the river still stood the blackened stone shells of the granaries. Some of the Kyrian and Rand had talked to claimed the torching of the granaries had led to riots, and then King Galdrian's death, and thus to the civil war. Others said Galdrian's assassination had caused the riots and the burning. Rand doubted that he would ever know which was the truth, or whether either was. A number of burned-out hulks dotted both banks of the wide river, but none lay close to the city. Aiel had an uneasiness, fear might be too strong a word, about bodies of water they could not step across or wade. But Culloden had managed to put barriers of floating logs across the Elguenya, both above and below Kyrian, along with enough men to see they were not cut. Fire arrows had done the rest. Nothing except rats and birds could get into or out of Kyrian without Culloden's leave. The hills around the city showed little sign of a besieging army. Here and there, vultures flapped heavily, no doubt feasting on the remains of some attempt to break out. But no Shido were visible. Aiel seldom were, unless they wanted to be. Wait. Rand swung the looking-glass back to a treeless hilltop perhaps a mile from the city walls. Back to a cluster of men. He could not discern faces, or much else aside from the fact that they all wore the cotton sore. One thing more. One of those men had bare arms. Culloden. Rand was sure it must be his imagination, but he thought that when Culloden moved, he could see sunlight glittering off the metallic scales encircling the man's forearms, in imitation of his own. Asmodian had put those there. Just an attempt to divert Rand's attention, to occupy him while Asmodian worked his own plans. But without that, how much would have turned out differently? Certainly he would not be standing on this tower, watching a besieged city and awaiting a battle. Suddenly, something streaked through the air on that distant hilltop. A long blur, and two of the men there went down thrashing. Staring at the fallen men, both apparently transfixed with the same spear, Culloden and the others seemed as stunned as Rand. Twisting the looking glass, Rand scanned for the man who had thrown with such force. He had to be brave, and a fool to get close enough. Rand's search widened quickly, beyond any possible range of a human arm. He was beginning to think of Ogier. Not likely. It took a great deal to rouse an Ogier into violence. When another streaking blur caught his eye. Startled, he half-straightened before jerking the glass back to Carrion's walls. That spear, or whatever it was, had come from there. How was another matter entirely. At this distance, it was all he could do to make out an occasional someone moving on the walls or atop a tower. Raising his head, Rand found Ruark just stepping away from the other looking glass, giving up his place to Han. That was the whole reason for the tower and the glasses. Scouts brought back what word they could of how the Shido were deployed, but this way the chiefs could see for themselves the terrain in which the battle would be fought. They had worked out a plan between them already, but one more look at the land could never go amiss. Rand did not know much about battles, but Lan thought their plan a good one. At least, Rand did not know much in his own mind. Sometimes those other memories crept in, and then he seemed to know more than he wanted. Did you see that? Those spears? Ruark looked as puzzled as Rand knew he himself must, but the Aiel nodded. The last took another Shido, but he crawled away. Not Culloden, worse luck. He gestured to the looking glass, and Rand let him take his place. Was it such bad luck? Culloden's death would not end the threat to Carrion, or to anywhere else. Now they were this side of the Dragon Wall, the Shido would not tamely return just because the man they thought was the true Ka-Karn died. It might well shake them, but not enough for that. And after all Rand had seen, he did not think Culloden deserved so easy a way out. I can be as hard as I must, he thought, stroking his sword hilt. For him I can. Chapter 42 Before the Arrow. The inside of a tent roof had to be the most boring sight in the world, but lying back in his shirt sleeves on scarlet-tasseled cushions that Melindra had acquired, Matt studied the gray-brown cloth intently. Or rather, he stared beyond it. One arm curled behind his head, he swirled a hammered silver goblet full of good wine from the south of Carrion. A small cask had cost him as much as 2 good horses would. As much as 2 horses would have, if the world and everything in it had not been stood on its head. But he counted it a small price for something decent. Sometimes a drop or two splashed over onto his hand, but he never noticed, and he never took a drink. By his book, matters had long since gone beyond merely serious. Sirius was being stuck in the waste with no idea of the way out. Sirius was dark friends popping up when you least expected, trollic attacks in the night, the odd murderer freezing your blood with an eyeless stare. That sort of thing came quickly and usually was done before you had much chance to think. It was certainly not what you would seek out, yet if you had to, you could live with it, if you could live through it. But for days he had known where they were heading and why. Nothing quick about it. Days to think. I am no bloody hero, he thought grimly. And I'm no bloody soldier. Fiercely he pushed down a memory of walking fortress walls, ordering his last reserves to where another crop of Trolloc scaling ladders had sprung up. That was not me. The light burn, whoever it was. He did not know what he was. A sour thought. But whatever he was, it involved gambling in taverns, women, and dancing. That he was sure of. It involved a good horse and every road in the world to choose from, not sitting and waiting for somebody to shoot arrows at him or try to stick a sword or a spear through his ribs. Any different would make him a fool, and he would not be that. Not for Rand or Moraine or anybody else. As he sat up, the silver foxhead medallion, hanging on its leather thong, slipped from the unlaced neck of his shirt. He tucked it back before taking a long swallow of wine. The medallion made him safe from Moraine or any other Aes Sedai, as long as they did not get it away from him. Surely one or another would try sooner or later. But nothing except his own wits kept him safe from some fool killing him, along with a few thousand other fools. Or from Rand, or from being Taviren. A man ought to be able to find a profit in something like that, having events twist themselves around him. Rand certainly had, in a way. He himself had never noticed anything twisting around him, except the fall of dice. He would not turn away from some of the things that happened to Taviren in stories. Wealth and fame dropped into their pockets as if from the sky. Men who wanted to kill them decided to follow instead, and women with ice in their eyes decided to melt. Not that he was complaining at what he had, really. And certainly not that he wanted anything like Rand's bargain. The price to get into the game was too high. It was just that he seemed to be stuck with all the burdens of being Taviren, and none of the pleasure. "It is time to go," he told the empty tent, then paused thoughtfully and sipped at the goblet. "It is time to get on Pips and ride. Ride to Camelin, maybe. Not a bad city, so long as he avoided the royal palace. Or Lugard." He had heard rumors about Lugard. A fine place, that, for the likes of him. "Time to leave Rand in my dust. He's got a bloody Aiel army and more maidens than he can count taking care of him. He doesn't need me." That last was not strictly true. In some strange way, he was tied to Rand's success or failure in Tarmangaden. Him and Perrin both. Three Taviren all tangled together. The histories would probably only mention Rand. Small chance he or Perrin would find any place in the stories. And then there was the Horn of Valir, which he did not want to think about and would not. Not until he had to. There might be some way out of that particular mess yet. Any way he looked at it, the horn was a problem for another day. A distant day. With luck, all those bills would come due on a very distant day. Only, that might take more luck than he had. The point now was that he had said all of that about going and felt scarcely a twinge. Not long ago, he had been unable even to speak of leaving. When he got too far from Rand, he had been drawn back like a hooked fish on some invisible line. Then he had become able to say it, even to lay plans, but the slightest thing would distract him, make him put off his schemes for stealing away. Even in Rhoydion, when he had told Rand he was going, he had been sure something would get in the way. It had, in a manner of speaking. Matt had made it out of the waste, but he was no further from Rand than before. This time he did not think he would be diverted. "Not like I'm abandoning him," he muttered. "If he can't bloody take care of himself by now, he'll never be able to. I'm not his bloody nursemaid." Draining the goblet, he scrambled into his green coat, settled his knives in their hiding places, arranged a dark yellow silk scarf to hide the hanging scar on his throat, then snatched up his hat and ducked out. Heat hit him in the face after the relatively cool shade inside. He was not sure how the seasons changed here, but summer was hanging on too long to suit him. One thing he had looked forward to on leaving the waste was the arrival of autumn. A little coolness. No luck here. At least the hat's wide brim kept the sun off. This hilly Kyrianan forest was a pitiful thing. More clearings than trees, and half of them going brown in the drought. Not a patch on the westwood back home. Low Aiel tents were everywhere, though at a distance they took on the look of a pile of dead leaves or a bare hummock of ground, unless the side flaps were up, and even then they were not easy to see. The Aiel going about their business did not look at him twice. From one crest as he crossed the encampment, he caught sight of Kadir's wagons, all in a circle, the drivers lying in the shade underneath, and the peddler nowhere in view. Kadir kept to his wagon more and more, seldom poking his nose out except when Moraine came to inspect the ladings. The Aiel ringing the wagons, small knots with spears and bucklers, bows and quivers, made little pretense of being anything but guards. Moraine must think Kadir or some of his men would try to make off with what she had brought out of Rudian. Matt wondered whether Rand realized that he was giving her anything and everything she asked. For a while, Matt had thought Rand had gotten the upper hand there, but he was not so sure any longer, even if Moraine did do everything but curtsy and fetch Rand's pipe. Rand's tent was on a hilltop by itself, naturally, that red banner on his staff at its front. It rippled in a light breeze, sometimes standing out enough to show the black and white disc. The thing made Matt's skin crawl as much as the dragon banner had. If a man wanted to avoid Aes Sedai entanglements, as any but an idiot would, the last thing to do was wave that symbol about. The slopes of the hill were bare, but maidens' tents encircled the foot of the hill and spread through the trees, up surrounding slopes, and down the other side. That was as usual, too, and so was the Wise One's camp within the Farder Aes Mai, dozens of low tents in shouting distance of Rand's hill, with white-robed Gaishine bustling about. There were only a few of the Wise Ones to be seen, yet they made up for lack of numbers with the stares that followed him. He had no idea how many could channel in that bunch, but they were a fair equal of Aes Sedai, weighing and measuring, when it came to stares. He picked up his pace, making an effort not to shrug uncomfortably. He could feel those eyes on his back as surely as he could have a poke from a stick. And he would have to run the same gauntlet coming out. Well, a few words with Rand, and it would be the last time he had to run it. Only when he pulled off his hat and ducked into Rand's tent, no one was there except Natale, lounging on the cushions with his gilded, dragon-carved harp propped against his knee, and a gold goblet in his hand. Matt grimaced and swore under his breath. He should have known as much. If Rand had been here, he would have had to pass through a circle of maidens right around the tent. Most likely he was up at that new-built tower. A good idea, that. Know the terrain. That was the second rule close behind know your enemy, and not much to choose between them. The thought put a sour twist to his mouth. Those rules came from other men's memories. The only rules he wanted to remember were never kiss a girl whose brothers have knife scars, and never gamble without knowing a back way out. He almost wished those memories of other men were still separate lumps in his brain, instead of oozing into his thoughts when he least expected. "Trouble with a bilious stomach?" Natale asked lazily. "One of the Wise Ones might have a route to cure it. Or you could try Moraine." Matt could not like the man. He always seemed to be thinking of a joke he did not mean to share, and he always looked as if he had three servants taking care of his clothes, all that snowy lace at collar and cuffs, always seeming freshly laundered. The fellow never appeared to sweat, either. Why Rand wanted him around was a mystery. He almost never played anything merry on that harp. "Will he be back soon?" Natale shrugged. "When he decides to. Perhaps soon, perhaps late. No man clocks the Lord Dragon. And few women." There it was again, that secretive smile. A touch bleak this time. "I'll wait." He meant to go through with this. Too many times he had found himself putting off going. Natale sipped at his wine, studying him across the goblet's rim. It was bad enough that Moraine and the Wise Ones watched him in that silent, searching way. Sometimes Egwene did, too. She had certainly changed, half Wise One and half Aes Sedai. But from Rand's gleeman, it was enough to set his teeth on edge. The best thing about leaving would be not having anyone look at him as if they would know in a minute what he was thinking, and already knew whether his small clothes were clean. Two maps lay spread out near the fire pit. One, copied in detail from a tattered map found in a half-burned town, covered northern Kyrian from west of the Alguenia, halfway to the spine of the world, while the other, newly drawn and sketchy, showed the land around the city. Slips of parchment held down with pebbles dotted both. If he was going to stay and ignore Natale's searching look at the same time, there was nothing for it but to study the maps. With the toe of his boot, he shifted a few pebbles on the map of the city so he could read what was written on the parchments. In spite of himself, he winced. If the Aiel scouts could count, Culloden had nearly 160,000 spears. Shido and those who had supposedly gone to join their societies among the Shido. A hard nut to crack, and prickly. This side of the spine of the world had not seen an army like that since Arthur Hawkwing's time. The second map showed the other clans that had crossed the Dragon Wall. All had now, in one force or another, strung out according to when they had left the Jangai and spread apart, but too close to here for comfort. The Shianda, the Kodara, the Durain, and the Miagoma. Between them, they apparently had at least as many spears as Culloden. They had not left many behind, if that was true. The seven clans with Rand almost doubled that, easily enough to face Culloden or the four clans. Either or. Not both. Not at once. But both at once might be what Rand had to fight. What the Aiel called the bleakness had to be affecting those clans, too. Every day still, men tossed down their weapons and vanished. But only a fool would think it lessened their numbers any more than it did Rand's. And there was always the possibility that some of those were going to Culloden. The Aiel did not speak of it very much or very freely, and masked the idea behind talk of joining societies. But even now, men and maidens decided they could not accept Rand, or what he had told them of themselves. Every morning some were missing, and not all left their spears behind.
A pretty situation, wouldn't you say?
Matt's head jerked up at Land's voice, but the warder had entered the tent alone. Just something to look at while I waited. Is Rand coming back?
He will be with us soon.
Thumbs tucked behind his sword belt, Land stood beside Matt, looking down at the map. His face gave away as much as a statue's would.
Tomorrow should bring the largest battle since Utter Hawkwing.
You don't say. Where was Rand? Still up on that tower, probably. Maybe he should go there.
No. He could end up herring all over the camp, always one step behind.
Rand would come here eventually. He wanted to talk about something besides Culloden. This fight is none of mine. I'm not running away from anything that concerns me in the least.
What about them?
He gestured to the slips representing the Miagoma and the others. Any word on whether they mean to join Rand? Or do they just intend to sit there watching?
Who can say?
Ruark doesn't seem to know any more than I do, and if the wise ones do, they are not telling. The only thing certain is that Culloden is not going anywhere.
Culloden again. Matt shifted uncomfortably and took a half step toward the entrance. No, he would wait.
Fastening his gaze on the maps, he pretended to study them further. Perhaps Lan would leave him in silence. He just wanted to say his piece to Rand and go. The warder appeared to want to talk, though.
What do you think, Master Gleeman? Should we rush down on Culloden with everything and crush him tomorrow?
That sounds as good to me as any other plan, Natale replied dourly.
Emptying the goblet down his throat, he dropped it on the carpets and picked up the harp to begin softly strumming something dark and funereal.
I lead no armies, warder. I command nothing save myself, and not always that.
Matt grunted, and Lan glanced at him before returning to his study of the maps.
You do not think it a good plan?
Why not?
He said it so casually that Matt answered without thinking. Two reasons. If you surround Culloden, trap him between you and the city, you might crush him against it. How long was Rand going to be? But you might push him right over the walls, too. From what I hear, he's nearly gotten over twice already, even without miners or siege engines, and the city is hanging on by its teeth. Say his piece and go. That was it.
Press him enough, and you'll find yourself fighting inside Gyrian. Nasty thing, fighting in a city. And the idea is to save the place, not finish ruining it. Those slips laid out on the maps themselves made it all so clear. Frowning, he squatted with his elbows on his knees. Lan got down with him, but he hardly noticed. A dicey problem and fascinating. Best if you try to shove him away. Hit him from the south, mainly. He pointed to the River Galen. It joined the Alguenia some miles north of the city. There are bridges up here. Leave the Shido a clear path to them. Always leave a way out unless you really want to find out how hard a man can fight when he's nothing to lose. His finger slid east. Wooded hills for the most part, it seemed. Probably not much different from right around here. A blocking force here on this side of the river will make sure they go for the bridges, if it's big enough and positioned right. Once they're moving, Culloden won't want to try fighting someone ahead of him while you're coming behind. Yes, almost exactly the same as at Genji. Not unless he's a complete fool, anyway. They might make it to the river in good order, but those bridges will choke them. I don't see Aiel swimming, or hunting fords out for that matter. Keep the pressure on, shove them across. With luck, you'll be able to harry them all the way to the mountains. It was like Quaendaig Fords, too, late in the Trolloc Wars, and on much the same scale. Not much different from the Tora Shan, either. Or Sulmine Gap, before Hawkwing found his stride. The names flickered through his head, the images of bloody fields forgotten even by historians. Absorbed in the map as he was, they did not register as anything but his own remembrances. Too bad you don't have more cavalry. Light cavalry is best for the harrying. Bite at the flanks, keep them running, and never let them settle to fight. But Aiel should do almost as well.
And the other reason? Lan asked quietly.
Matt was caught up in it now. He more than merely liked gambling, and battle was a gamble to make dicing in taverns a thing for children and toothless invalids. Lives were the stake here, your own and other men's. Men who were not even there. Make the wrong wager, a foolish bet, and cities died, or whole nations. Natale's somber music was fit accompaniment. At the same time, this was a game that set the blood racing. Without lifting his eyes from the map, he snorted.
You know as well as I. If even one of those four clans decides to side with Culloden, they'll take you from behind while your hands are still full of Shido. Culloden will be the anvil, and they the hammer, with you the nut between. Only take half of what you have against Culloden. That makes it an even fight, but you'll have to settle for it.
There was no such thing as fairness in war. You took your enemy from behind, when he least expected it, when and where he was weakest. You still have an edge. He has to worry about a sortie from the city. The other half you split in three parts. One to funnel Kulit into the river, the other two a few miles apart, between the city and the four clans.
Very neat, Lan said, nodding.
That slab-carved face never changed, but approval touched his voice, if lightly.
It would gain a clan nothing to attack either force, especially not when the other could take it in the rear. And none will try to interfere in what happens around the city for the same reason. Of course, all four could join. Not likely, if they haven't already. But if they do, everything changes.
Matt laughed aloud.
Everything always changes. The best plan lasts until the first arrow leaves the bow. This would be easy enough for a child to handle, except for Indirian and the rest not knowing their own minds. If they all decide to go over to Culloden, you toss the dice in hope, because the Dark One's in the game for sure. At least you'll have enough strength clear of the city nearly to match them. Enough to hold them for the time you need. Abandon the idea of pursuing Culloden and turn everything on them as soon as he's well and truly begun crossing the Galen. But it's my bet they'll wait and watch and come to you once Culloden is done for. Victory settles a lot of arguments in most men's heads.
The music had stopped, Matt glanced at Natail and found the man holding his harp rigidly, staring at him over it harder than ever. Staring as if he had never seen him before, did not know what he was. The gleeman's eyes were dark polished glass, his knuckles white on the harp's gilding. With that, it all crashed home, what he had been saying, the memories he had been embracing.
Burn you for a fool for not guarding your tongue.
Why had Lan had to take the conversation that way? Why could he not have talked about horses or the weather, or just kept his mouth shut? The warder had never seemed all that eager to talk before. Usually the man made a tree seem talkative. Of course, he could have kept his own mind focused and his own mouth shut, too. At least he had not been babbling in the old tongue. Blood and ashes, but I hope I wasn't. Springing to his feet, Matt turned to go and found Rand standing just inside the tent, absently twisting that odd bit of tasseled spear, as if he did not realize he was holding it. How long had he been there? It did not matter. Matt spilled it all out in a rush.
I'm leaving, Rand. Come first light in the morning, I am in the saddle and gone. I'd go this minute if I could get far enough in half a day to suit me for stopping. I mean to put as many miles between me and the Aiel, any Aiel, as Pips can cover before I make camp.
No point in bedding down close enough to be snapped up and hung out to dry by somebody's scouts. Cooladin must have them out, too, and even the others might not recognize him before he had a spear in his liver.
I will be sorry to see you go, Rand said quietly.
Don't try to talk me out of...
Matt blinked.
That's it? You'll be sorry to see me go?
I've never tried to make you stay, Matt. Perrin went when he had to, and so can you. Matt opened his mouth, then closed it again. Rand had never tried to make him stay, true. He had just done it without trying. But there was not the slightest bit of Taviran tugging now, no vague feelings that he was doing the wrong thing. He was firm and clear in his purpose.
Where will you go?
South. Not that there was much choice of direction. The others led to the Galen, with nothing north of the river that he was interested in, or else to Aiel, one lot that would certainly kill him, and one that might or might not, depending on how close by Rand was and what they had had for supper the night before. Not good odds by his reckoning.
To begin, anyway. Then somewhere there's a tavern, and some women who don't carry spears.
Melindra. She might present a problem. He had the feeling she might be the sort of woman who did not let go until she wanted. Well, one way or another, he would deal with her. Maybe he could just ride out before she knew it.
This isn't for me, Rand. I don't know anything about battles, and I don't want to know.
He avoided looking at Lan and Natail. If either man cracked his teeth, he would punch him right in the mouth. Even the warder.
You understand, don't you?
Rand's nod could have been understanding. Maybe it was. I'd forget saying goodbye to Egwene, were I you. I'm no longer certain how much of what I tell her might as well be telling Moraine or the Wise Ones or both.
I reached that conclusion a long time ago. She's left Emmons Field further behind than either of us, and regrets it less.
Maybe, Rand said sadly. The light shine on you, Matt, he added, sticking out his hand, and send you smooth roads, fair weather, and pleasant company until we meet again. That would not be soon if Matt had his way. He felt a little sad about that, and a little foolish for feeling sad. Yet a man had to look after himself. When all was said and done, that was the long and short of it. Rand's grip was as hard as it had ever been. All that sword work had only added new calluses atop older bowmen's. But the ridged heron brand in his palm was distinct against Matt's hand. Just a little reminder in case he should forget the markings under his friend's coat sleeves, or those even stranger things inside his head that let him channel. If he could forget that Rand could channel, and he had not thought of it once in days, then it was far past time to be gone. A few more awkward words standing there. Lan seemed to ignore them, arms folded, silently studying the maps, while Natail had begun idly plucking his harp. Matt had an ear for music, and to him the unfamiliar tune had an ironic sound. He wondered why the fellow had chosen it. A few more moments, and Rand, half-stepping around, actually putting an end to it, and then Matt was outside. There was a crowd out there, a good 100 maidens spread about the hilltop and walking on tiptoe, they were so ready to spear somebody. All 7 clan chiefs waiting patient and still as stone, 3 Tyran lords trying to pretend they were not sweating, and the Aiel did not exist. He had heard about the lord's arrival, and had even gone to take a look at their camp, or camps, but there had been no one there he knew, and no one wanting to take a turn at dice or cards. These 3 eyed him up and down, frowning disdainfully, and apparently decided he was no better than the Aiel, which was to say, not worth seeing. Clapping his hat on his head, and pulling the brim low over his eyes, Matt studied the tyrants coldly in return for a moment. He had the pleasure of seeing the younger pair, at least, become uncomfortably aware of him again, before he started down the hill. The graybeard still looked all barely concealed impatience to enter Rand's tent, but it did not matter anyway. He would never see any of them again. He had no idea why he had not simply ignored them, except that his step was lighter and he felt full of vinegar. No wonder, really, leaving tomorrow at last. The dice seemed to be spinning in his head, and there was no knowing what pips would show when they landed. Odd, that. It must be Melindra worrying him. Yes. He would definitely leave early, and as quietly as a mouse tiptoeing on feathers. Whistling, he set off for his tent. What was the tune? Oh, yes. Dance with Jack of the Shadows. He had no intention of dancing with death, but it had a merry sound, so he whistled it anyway, as he tried to plan the best route away from Kyrian. Rand stood staring after Matt, long after the tent flaps had fallen to hide him. "I only heard the last bit," he said finally. "Was it all like that?" "Very nearly," Lan replied. With only a few minutes to study the maps, he laid out close to the battle plan that Ruark and the others made. He saw the difficulties and the dangers and how to meet them. He knows about miners and siege engines, and using light cavalry to harry a defeated foe. Rand looked at him. The warder showed no surprise, not the twitch of an eyelash. Of course, he was the one who had said Matt seemed surprisingly knowledgeable about military matters. And Lan was not going to ask the obvious question either, which was good. Rand had no right to give the little answer he had. He could have asked a few questions himself, such as, what did miners have to do with battles? Or maybe it was only sieges. Whatever the answer, there was not a mine closer than the Dragon's Dagger, and no certainty anyone was still digging ore. Well, this battle would be fought without. The important thing was that he knew Matt had gained more on the other side of that doorway Tirangriel than a tendency to spout the old tongue when not thinking. And knowing that, Rand would surely make use of it. "You don't have to get any harder," he thought bitterly. He had seen Matt climbing toward this tent and never hesitated in sending Lan in to discover what might come to the surface in idle conversation alone. That had been deliberate. The rest might or might not be, but it would happen. He hoped Matt had a fine time while he was free. He hoped that Perrin was enjoying himself in the 2 rivers, showing off Fael to his mother and sisters, maybe marrying her. He hoped it because he knew he would draw them back, Taviren pulling at Taviren, and he the strongest. Moraine had named it no coincidence, 3 such growing up in the same village. All nearly the same age. The wheel wove happenstance and coincidence into the pattern, but it did not lay down the likes of the 3 of them for no reason. Eventually he would pull his friends back to him, however far they went, and when they came, he would use them however he could. However he had to. Because he did have to. Because, whatever the prophecy of the dragon said, he was sure the only chance he had of winning Tarmogaden lay in having all 3 of them, 3 Taviren who had been tied together since infancy, tied together once more. No. He did not need to become hard.
You're rank enough already to make a Shan-Chan spew his supper.
Play March of Death, he commanded in a harsher voice than he wanted, and the tail looked at him blankly for a moment. The man had been listening to everything. He would have questions, but he would find no answers. If Rand could not tell Lan Matt's secrets, he would not spread them before one of the Forsaken, however tame he appeared. This time he deliberately made his tone rough and pointed the length of spear at the man. Play it, unless you know a sadder. Play something to make your soul weep, if you have one still. Natale gave him an ingratiating smile and a seated bow, but he went white around the eyes. It was indeed the March of Death that he began, yet it had a sharper edge on his harp than ever before, a dirge-like keen that surely would make any soul weep. He stared fixedly at Rand, as if hoping to see some effect. Turning away, Rand stretched out on the carpets with his head to the maps and a red and gold cushion under his elbow. Lan, would you ask the others to come in now? The warder made a formal bow before stepping outside. It was the first time that he had ever done that, but Rand noticed only absently. The battle would begin tomorrow. It was a polite fiction that he helped Ruark and the others plan. He was smart enough to know what he did not know, and despite all of his talks with Lan and Ruark, he knew he was not ready. I've planned 100 battles this size or more and given orders that led to 10 times as many. Not his thought. Luz Theron knew war, had known war, but not Randall Thor, and that was him. He listened, asked questions, and nodded as if he understood when the chiefs said a thing should be done a certain way. Sometimes he did understand, and wished he did not, because he knew where that understanding came from. His only real contribution had been to say that Cúlladin had to be defeated without destroying the city. In any case, this meeting would only add a few touches, at most, to what had already been decided. Matt would have been useful with his newfound knowledge. No. He would not think of his friends, of what he would do to them before it was all done. Even leaving the battle aside, there was plenty to occupy him. Things he could do something about. The absence of Cairhienan flags above Cairhien marked a major problem, and the continued skirmishes with Andorans another. What Samael was up to warranted thought, and the chiefs filed in no particular order. This time Derek came first, Ruark and Erim together at the rear with Lan. Bruan and Jaren took the places next to Rand. They did not concern themselves with precedence among themselves, and on a line they seemed to take as all but one of them. Wairamon entered last, his lordlings at his heels, and a tight-mouthed scowl on his face. Precedence certainly mattered to him. Muttering into his oiled beard, he stalked his way around the fire pit, taking up a place behind Rand. Until the chief's flat stares finally broke through his shell, at least. Among Aiel, a close kinsman or society brother might position himself so, if there was the possibility of a knife in the back. He still frowned at Jaren and Derek, as though expecting one of them to make room. Finally, Bale gestured to the place beside him, across the maps from Rand, and after a pause, Wireman strode back to sit cross-legged and rigid, staring straight ahead and looking like a man who had swallowed an unripe plum whole. The younger Tyrans stood almost as stiffly at his back, one with the grace to look embarrassed. Rand took note of him, but said not a word, only thumbed his pipe full of tobacco and seized Sidon long enough to light it. He had to do something about Wireman. The man exacerbated old problems and made new ones. Not a flicker crossed Ruark's features, but the other chief's expressions ranged from Han's sour disgust to Aram's clear, cold-eyed readiness to dance spears there and then. Perhaps there was a way for Rand to rid himself of Wireman and make a beginning on another of his worries at the same time. With Rand's example, Lan and the chiefs began filling pipes.
"I see only small changes necessary," Bale said, puffing his pipe alight,
and sparking a glower from Han, as usual.
"Do these small changes concern the Goshin, or perhaps some other clan?"
Putting Wireman from his mind, Rand bent himself to listening as they worked out what had to be altered from their new view of the terrain. Now and again, one of the Aiel would glance at Natale, a brief tightness to his eyes or mouth suggesting that the mournful music plucked at something in him. Even the Tyrans grimaced sadly. The sounds washed over Rand, though, touching nothing. Tears were a luxury he could no longer afford. Not even inside. Chapter 43. This place, this day. The next morning Rand was up and dressed well before first light. In truth, he had not slept. And it had not been Avienda who kept him awake, not even after she began undressing before he could put out the lamps, and channeled one alight again as soon as he did, chiding him that she was unable to see in the dark even if he could. He made no reply, and hours later had hardly noticed when she rose, a good hour before he did, dressed, and left. He did not even think to wonder where she was going. The thoughts that had had him staring up into the blackness still ran through his head. Men would die today. A great many men, even if everything went perfectly. Nothing he did now would change that. Today would run out according to the pattern. But over and over he mulled the decisions he had made since he first entered the waste. Could he have done something different? Something that would have avoided this day, this place? Next time, perhaps. The tasseled length of spear lay atop his sword belt and scabbarded blade beside his blankets. There would be a next time, and one beyond that, and beyond again. While darkness still held, the chiefs came in a bunch for a few final words to report that their men were in position and ready. Not that anything else was expected. Stone-faced as they were, some emotion showed. An odd mix, though. A skim of ebullience over somberness. Aram actually wore a slight smile.
"A good day to see the end of the Shido," he said finally.
He seemed to be walking on his toes.
"The light willing," Bale said, his head brushing the roof of the tent. "We will wash the spears in Culloden's blood before sunfall."
"Bad luck to talk of what will be," Han muttered.
The skim was very thin on him, of course.
"Fate will decide."
Rand nodded.
"The light sendit does not decide on too many of our number dead."
He wished his concern were only that few men should die, because men should not have their lives cut short. But there were many more days to come. He would need every spear to bring order to this side of the Dragon Wall. That was a bone between him and Culloden, every bit as much as the rest.
"Life is a dream,"
Ruark told him, and Han and the others nodded agreement. Life was only a dream, and all dreams had to end. Aiel did not run toward death, yet they did not run from it either. As they were departing, Bale paused.
"Are you certain of what you want the maidens to do? Sulin has been speaking to the wise ones."
So that was what Malayne had been at Bale about. The way Ruark stopped to listen, he had been hearing from Amis on the subject, too. "Everyone else is doing what they are supposed to without complaining, Bale." That was unfair, but this was no game. "If the maidens want special consideration, Sulin can come to me, not go running to the wise ones." Had they been anything but Aiel, Ruark and Bale would have been shaking their heads as they left. Rand supposed each would get an earful from his wife, but they would have to live with it. If Fardarai's Mai carried his honor, this time they would carry it where he wanted. To Rand's surprise, Lan appeared just as he was ready to go out himself. The warder's cloak hung down his back, disturbing the vision as it rippled with his movements.
"Is Moraine with you?" Rand had expected Lan to be glued to her side.
"She is fretting in her tent. She cannot possibly heal even all of the worst hurt today."
That was her choice of how to help.
She could not use the power as a weapon today, but she could heal.
Waste always angers her.
It angers us all, Rand snapped. His taking Egwene away probably upset her, too. As far as he could tell, Egwene was not very good at healing on her own, but she could have aided Moraine. Well, he needed her to keep her promise. Tell Moraine if she needs help, ask some of the wise ones who can channel. But few wise ones had any knowledge of healing. She can link with them and use their strength. He hesitated. Had Moraine ever spoken of linking to him?
You didn't come here to tell me Moraine is brooding, he said irritably.
It was difficult sometimes keeping straight what came from her, what from Asmodian, and what bubbled up from Luz Theron.
I came to ask why you've taken to wearing a sword again.
Moraine asked already. Did she send...
Lan's face did not change, but he cut in roughly. I want to know. You can make a sword from the power or kill without. But suddenly you are wearing steel on your hip again.
Why?
Unconsciously, Rand ran one hand up the long hilt at his side.
It's hardly fair to use the power that way, especially against someone who can't channel. I might as well fight a child.
The warder stood silent for a time, studying him. You mean to kill Culloden yourself, he said at last in flat tones. That sword against his spears.
I don't mean to seek him out, but who can say what will happen?
Rand shrugged uncomfortably. Not to hunt for him, but if ever his twisting of chance was to favor him, let it be to bring him face to face with Culloden.
Besides, I'd not put it past him to seek me.
The threats I've heard from him have been personal, Lan.
Raising one fist, he thrust his arm out of a crimson coat sleeve, enough to make the golden-maned dragon's forend visible.
Culloden won't rest while I live, not so long as we both wear these.
And truth to tell, he would not rest himself until only one living man bore the dragons. By rights, he should lump Asmodian in with Culloden. Asmodian had marked the Shido, but Culloden's unrestrained ambition had made it possible. His ambition and refusal to abide by Aiel law and custom had led inevitably to this place, this day. Beyond the bleakness and war between Aiel, there was Tyen to be laid at Culloden's feet, and Celion, and dozens of ruined towns and villages since, countless hundreds of burned farms. Unburied men and women and children had fed the vultures. If he was the dragon reborn, if he had any right to demand that any nation follow him, much less Kyrian, then he owed them justice.
Then have him beheaded when he's taken, Lan said harshly. Set 100 men or 1,000 with no purpose but to find and take him. But do not be fool enough to fight him. You are good with a blade now, very good. But Aielmen are all but born with spear and buckler in hand. A spear through your heart, and all has been for naught.
So I should avoid the fighting. Would you, if Moraine had no claims on you? Will Ruark or Bale, or any of them?
I am not the dragon reborn. The fate of the world does not rest on me.
But the momentary heat had gone from his voice. Without Moraine, he would have been wherever the fighting was hottest. If anything, he looked to be regretting those claims at the moment.
I'll not take needless risks, Lan, but I can't run from them all.
The Seanchan spear would remain in the tent today. It would only get in his way if he did find Culloden.
Come. The Aiel will finish it without us if we stand here much longer.
When he ducked outside, only a few stars remained, and a thin brightness outlined the eastern horizon sharply. That was not why he stopped, though, and Lan with him. Maidens made a ring around the tent, shoulder to shoulder, facing inward. A thick ring that spread down the dark, shrouded slopes, caught in sore-clad women jammed so a mouse could not have slipped through. Jaden was nowhere in sight, though a Gaishain had been ordered to have him saddled and waiting. Not maidens alone. Two women in the front rank wore bulky skirts and pale blouses, their hair bound back with folded scarves. It was too black yet to discern faces with any certainty, but there was something in the shape of those two, in their folded arm stance, that named Egwene and Avienda. Sulin stepped forward before he could open his mouth to ask what they were up to.
"We have come to escort the Kaakon to the tower with Egwene Sedai and Avienda."
"Who put you up to this?" Rand demanded. One glance at Lan showed it had not been him. Even in the darkness, the warder looked startled. For a moment, anyway, his head jerking up. Nothing surprised Lan for long. "Egwene is supposed to be on her way to the tower now, and the maidens are supposed to be there to guard her. What she will do today is very important. She must be protected while she does it."
"We will protect her."
Sulin's voice was as flat as a planed board.
"And the Kaakon, who gave his honor to Fardarai's Mai to carry."
A murmur of approval rippled through the maidens.
"It only makes sense, Rand," Egwene said from where she stood. "If one using the power as a weapon will make the battle shorter, three will shorten it even more. And you are stronger than Avienda and me together."
She did not sound as if she liked saying that last. Avienda said nothing, but the way she stood was eloquent.
"This is ridiculous," Rand scowled. "Let me through, and go to your assigned place."
Sulin did not budge.
"Fardarai's Mai carries the honor of the Kaakon," she said calmly, and the others took it up. No louder, but from so many women's voices, it made a high rumble. "Fardarai's Mai carries the honor of the Kaakon. Fardarai's Mai carries the honor of the Kaakon." "I said let me through," he demanded the instant the sound died.
As if he had told them to begin again, they did.
"Fardarai's Mai carries the honor of the Kaakon. Fardarai's Mai carries the honor of the Kaakon."
Sulin just stood there looking at him. After a moment, Lan leaned close to murmur dryly, "A woman is no less a woman because she carries a spear. Did you ever meet one who could be diverted from anything she really wanted? Give over, or we will stand here all day while you argue and they chanted you." The warder hesitated, then added, "Besides which, it does make sense." Egwene opened her mouth as the litany fell off once more, but Avienda put a hand on her arm and whispered a few words, and Egwene said nothing. He knew what she had intended to say, though. She had been about to tell him he was a stubborn, foolish woolhead or some such. The trouble was that he was beginning to feel like one. It did make sense for him to go to the tower. He had nothing to do elsewhere. The battle was in the hands of the chiefs and fate now. And he would be of more use channeling than riding around hoping to meet with Culloden. If being Taviren could pull Culloden to him, it could draw him to the tower as easily as anywhere else. Not that he would have much chance of seeing the man, not after ordering every last maiden to defend the tower. But how to back down and retain a scrap of dignity after blustering left, right, and center?
"I've decided I can do the most good from the tower," he said, his face going hot. "As the Kaakon commands," Sulin replied without a hint of mockery, just as if it had been his idea from the first.
Lan nodded, then slipped away, the maidens making narrow room for him. The gap closed up right behind Lan, though, and when they began to move, Rand had no choice except to go with them. He could have channeled, of course, flung fire about, or knocked them down with air, but that was hardly the way to behave with people on his side, let alone women. Besides, he was not sure he could have made them leave him short of killing, and maybe not then. And anyway, he had decided he was of most use at the tower after all. Egwene and Avienda were as silent as Sulin as they walked, for which he was grateful. Of course, at least part of their silence had to do with picking their way uphill and down in the dark without breaking their necks. Avienda did raise a mutter now and then that he barely caught, something angry about skirts. But neither made fun of him for backing down so visibly, though that might well come later. Women seem to enjoy jabbing the needle in just when you thought the danger was past. The sky began to lighten into gray, and as the log tower came into sight above the trees, he broke the quiet himself.
"I didn't expect you to be part of this, Avienda. I thought you said wise ones take no part in battles."
He was sure she had. A wise one could walk through the middle of a battle untouched, or into any hold or stand of a clan that had blood feud with hers, but she took no part in fighting, certainly not with channeling. Until he came to the waste, even most Aiel had not really known that some wise ones could channel, though there were rumors of strange abilities, and sometimes something the Aiel thought might be close to channeling.
"I am not a wise one yet," she replied pleasantly, shifting her shawl.
"If an Aes Sedai like Egwene can do this, so can I. I arranged it this morning, while you still slept. But I have thought of it since you first asked Egwene."
There was enough light now for him to see Egwene flush. When she saw him glancing at her, she tripped over nothing, and he had to catch her arm to keep her from falling. Avoiding his eyes, she jerked free. Maybe he would not have to worry about any needles from her.
They started uphill through the sparse woods toward the tower.
"They didn't try to stop you. Amis, I mean, or Bear, or Malayne?"
He knew they had not. If they had, she would not be there. Avienda shook her head, then frowned thoughtfully.
"They talked for a long time with Sor Alea, then told me to do as I thought I must. Usually they tell me to do as they think I must."
Glancing at him sideways, she added,
"I heard Malayne say that you bring change to everything."
"I do that," he said, setting his foot on the bottom rung of the first ladder. "The light help me, that I do."
The view from the platform was magnificent, even to the naked eye. The land spreading out in wooded hills. The trees were thick enough to hide the Aiel moving toward Carrion. Most would already be in position. But dawn cast the city itself into golden light.
A quick scan through one of the looking glasses showed the barren hills along the river placid and seemingly empty of life. That would change soon enough. The Shido were there, if concealed for now. They would not remain concealed when he began to direct... what? Not Balefire. Whatever he did, it had to unnerve the Shido as much as possible before his Aiel attacked.
Egwene and Avienda had been taking turns looking through the other long tube, with pauses for quiet discussion, but now they were simply talking softly. Exchanging nods finally, they moved closer to the railing and stood with their hands in the rough-hewn timber, staring toward Carrion. Goosebumps suddenly dotted his skin. One of them was channeling, maybe both. It was the wind that he noticed first, blowing toward the city. Not a breeze, the first real wind he had felt in this country. And clouds were beginning to form above Carrion, heaviest to the south, growing thicker and blacker as he watched, roiling. Only there, over Carrion and the Shido. Everywhere else, as far as he could see, the sky was a clear blue, with only a few high, thin white wisps. Yet thunder rolled long and solid. Suddenly lightning stabbed down, a jagged silver streak that rent a hilltop below the city. Before the crack of the first bolt reached the tower, two more crackled earthward. Wild forks danced across the sky, but those single lances of brilliant white struck with the regularity of a heartbeat. Abruptly, ground exploded where no lightning had fallen, fountaining 50 feet, then again somewhere else, and again. Rand had no idea which woman was doing what, but they certainly looked set to harrow the Shido out. Time to do his bit or stand watching. Reaching out, he seized Saidin. Icy fire scoured the outside of the void that surrounded what was Randall Thor. Coldly, he ignored the oily filth seeping into him from the taint, juggled wild torrents of the power that threatened to engulf him. At this distance, there were limits to what he could do. In fact, it was about as far as he could do anything, really, without Angreal or Saangreal. Very likely that was why the women were channeling one lightning bolt at a time, one explosion. If he was at his boundary, they must be stretching theirs. A memory slid across the emptiness. Not his, Luz Theron's. For once, he did not care. In an instant, he channeled, and a ball of fire enveloped the top of a hill nearly 5 miles away, a churning mass of pale yellow flame. When it faded, he could see without the looking glass that the hill was lower now,
and black at the crest, seemingly melted. Between the three of them, there might be no need for the clans to fight Culloden at all.
Ilyena, my love, forgive me.
The void trembled. For an instant, Rand teetered on the brink of destruction. Waves of the One Power crashed through him in a froth of fear. The taint seemed to solidify around his heart, a reeking stone. Clutching the rail until his knuckles ached, he forced himself back to calmness, forced the emptiness to hold. Thereafter, he refused to listen to the thoughts in his head. Instead, he concentrated everything on channeling, on methodically searing one hill after another. Standing well back into what tree line there was on the crest, Matt held Pips's nose under his arm so the gelding would not wicker as he watched a thousand or so Aiel slanting toward him across the hills from the south. The sun was just peeking over the horizon, stretching long rippling shadows to one side of the trotting mass. The night's warmth was already beginning to give way to the heat of day. The air would swelter once the sun reached any height. He was already beginning to sweat. The Aiel had not seen him yet, but he had few doubts that they would if he waited there much longer. It hardly mattered that they very nearly had to be Rand's men. If Culloden had men to the south, the day was going to get very interesting for those stupid enough to be in the middle of the fighting. Hardly mattered because he was not going to run the risk of letting them see him. He had already come too close to an arrow this morning for that kind of carelessness. Absently, he fingered the neat slice across the shoulder of his coat. Good shooting at a moving target only half seen through trees. He could have admired it more had he not been the target. Without taking his eyes from the approaching Aiel, he carefully backed Pips deeper into the sparse thicket. If they saw him and picked up their pace, he wanted to know. People said Aiel could run down a man on horseback, and he meant to have a good lead if they tried. Not until the trees hid them from him did he quicken his own step, leading Pips onto the reverse slope before mounting and turning west. A man could not be too careful if he wanted to stay alive on this day, on this ground. He muttered to himself as he rode, hat pulled low to shade his face, and black-hafted spear across his pommel. West. Again. The day had begun so well. A good 2 hours before first light, when Melindra had gone off to some meeting of the maidens. Thinking him asleep, she had not glanced at him as she stalked out, muttering half under her breath about Randall Thor and honor, and Fardarai's Mai above all. She sounded as if she were arguing with herself, but frankly he did not care whether she wanted to pickle Rand or stew him. Before she was a minute out of the tent, he was stuffing his saddlebags. No one had so much as looked at him twice while he saddled Pips and ghosted away to the south. A good beginning. Only he had not counted on columns of Tardad and Tomanel and every other bloody clan sweeping around to the south. No consolation that it was very close to what he had babbled to Lan. He wanted to go south, and those Aiel had forced him toward the Alguenia, toward where the fighting would be. A mile or two on, he cautiously turned Pips upslope, pausing deep in the scattered trees in the crest. It was a higher hill than most, and he had a good view. This time there were no Aiel in sight, but the column winding along the bottom of the twisting hill valley was almost as bad. Mounted Tyrans had the lead behind a knot of colorful lords' banners, with a gap back to a thick, bristling snake of pikemen in the Tyrans' dust, and then another to the Kyrianan horse, with their multitude of banners and pennants and khan. The Kyrianan maintained no order at all, milling about as lords shifted back and forth for conversation, but at least they had flankers out to either side. In any case, as soon as they were past, he had a clear route south. And I'll not stop until I'm halfway to the bloody Aranin. A flicker of movement caught his eye, well ahead of the column below. He would not have seen it except for being so high. None of the riders could have, certainly. Digging his small looking glass from his saddlebags, Kintor Vir liked the dice, he peered toward what he had seen and whistled softly through his teeth. Aiel, at least as many as the men in the valley, and if they were not Culloden's, they meant to give a name-day surprise, for they were lying low among the dying bushes and dead leaves. For a moment he drummed fingers on his thigh. Shortly, there were going to be some corpses down there. And not many of them Aiel. None of my affair. I am out of this, out of here, and heading south. He would wait a bit, then head off while they were all too busy to notice. This fellow Wireman, he had heard the Greybeard's name yesterday, was a stone fool. No foreguard out, and no scouts, or he'd know what was bloody in store for him. For that matter, the way the hills lay, the way the valley twisted, the Aiel could not see the column either. Only its thin dust rising skyward. They certainly had had scouts to get themselves in place. They could not just be waiting there on the off chance. Idly whistling Dance with Jack of the Shadows, he put the looking glass back to his eye and studied the hilltops. Yes, the Aiel commander had left a few men where they could signal a warning just before the column entered the killing ground. But even they could not possibly see anything yet. In a few minutes, the first Tyrans would come in sight, but until then... It came as a shock when he heeled Pips to a gallop downslope. What under the light am I doing? Well, he could not just stand by and let them all go to their deaths like geese to the knife. He would warn them. That was all. Tell what lay in wait ahead, then he was gone. The Kyrianan outriders saw him coming before he reached the bottom of the slope, of course, heard Pips's dead-flat charge. Two or three lowered their lances. Matt did not precisely enjoy having a foot and a half of steel pointed at him, and still less three times over. But obviously one man was no threat, even riding like a madman. They let him pass, and he swung in near the lead Kyrianan lords long enough to shout, "Halt here! Now! By order of the Lord Dragon! Else he'll channel your head into your belly and feed you your own feet for breakfast." His heels dug in and Pips sprang ahead. He only glanced back to be sure they were doing what he said. They were, if showing some confusion over it. The hills hid them from the Aiel still, and once their dust settled, the Aiel would have no way of knowing they were there. And then he was lying low over the gelding's neck, whipping Pips with his hat and galloping up alongside the infantry. "If I wait to let Wireman pass the orders, it'll be too late, that's all." He would give his warning and go. The foot marched in blocks of 200 or so pikemen, with one mounted officer in front of each, and maybe 50 archers or crossbowmen at the rear. Most looked at him curiously as he dashed by, Pips's heels kicking up spurts of dust, but none broke stride. Some of the officers' mounts frisked as if the riders wanted to come see what had him in such a hurry, but none of them left their places either. Good discipline. They would need it. Defenders of the stone brought up the tail end of the Tyrans, in their breastplates and puffy black and gold striped coat sleeves, plumes of various colors on the rimmed helmets marking officers and under-officers. The rest were armored the same, but bore the colors of various lords in their sleeves. The silk-coated lords themselves rode at the very front in ornate breastplates and large white plumes, their banners rippling behind them in a rising breeze toward the city. Reining around in front of them so quickly that Pips danced, Matt shouted, "Halt! In the name of the Lord Dragon!" It seemed the fastest way to stop them, but for a moment he thought they meant to ride right over him. Almost at the last moment, a young lord he remembered from outside Rand's tent flung up a hand, and then they were all drawing rein in a flurry of shouted orders that ran back along the column. Wireman was not there. Not a lord was as much as 10 years older than Matt. "What is the meaning of this?" demanded the fellow who had signaled. Dark eyes glared arrogantly down a sharp nose, chin lifted so his pointed beard looked ready to stab. Sweat trickling down his face spoiled it only a little. "The Lord Dragon himself gave me this command. Who are you to—" He cut off as another man Matt knew caught his sleeve, whispering urgently. Potato-faced Estion looked haggard beneath his helmet as well as hot. The Aiel had rung him out concerning conditions in the city, so Matt had heard. But he had gambled at cards with Matt in Tyr. He knew exactly who Matt was. Estion's breastplate alone had chips in the ornate gilding. None of the others had done more than ride around looking pretty. Yet. Sharp Nose's chin came down as he listened, and when Estion left off, he spoke in a more moderate tone.
No offense intended, Lord Matt. I am Melanreel, of House Asegora. How may I serve the Lord Dragon?
Moderation slipped into actual hesitation at that last, and Estion broke in anxiously.
Why should we halt? I know the Lord Dragon told us to hold back, Matt, but burn my soul, there's no honor in sitting and letting the Aiel do all the fighting. Why shall we be saddled with chasing them after they've broken? Besides, my father is in the city, and—
He trailed off under Matt's stare. Matt shook his head, fanning himself with his hat. The fools were not even where they should be. There was no chance of turning them back, either. If Melanreel would go, and looking at him, Matt was not sure he would, even on supposed orders from the Lord Dragon, there was still no chance. He sat his saddle in plain sight of the Aiel lookouts. If the column started turning around, they would know themselves discovered, and very likely they would attack while the Tyrans and the Cariennan Pike were tangled up. It would be a slaughter as surely as if they had gone ahead in ignorance.
"Where is Wyraman?" "The Lord Dragon sent him back to Tyr," Melanreel replied slowly, "to deal with the Ilionar pirates and the bandits on the plains of Marido. He was reluctant to go, of course, even for so great a responsibility, but—" "Pardon, Lord Matt, but if the Lord Dragon sent you, how is it that you don't know—"
Matt cut him off.
"I am no lord, and if you want to question what Rand lets people know, ask him."
That set the fellow back. He was not about to question the Lord Bloody Dragon about anything. Wyraman was a fool, but at least he was old enough to have been in a battle. Except for Estion, looking like a sack of turnips tied on his horse, all this lot had seen was a tavern fight or two, and maybe a few duels. Fat lot of good that would do them.
"Now you all listen to me. When you pass through that gap ahead, between the next two hills, Aiel are going to come down on you like an avalanche."
He might as well have told them there was going to be a ball with the women all sighing to meet a Tyran lordling. Eager grins broke out, and they started dancing their horses about, slapping each other on the shoulder and boasting how many they would kill. Estion was odd man out, just sighing and easing his sword in its scabbard.
"Don't stare up there,"
Matt snapped. The fools. In a minute they would be calling the charge.
"Keep your eyes on me. On me!"
It was who he was friends with that settled them down. Melanreel and the others in their fine, unmarked armor frowned impatiently, not understanding why he did not want to let them begin the business of killing Aiel savages. If he had not been Rand's friend, they probably would have trampled him and Pips both. He could not let them go charging off. They would do it piecemeal, leaving the pikes and the Cariennan horse behind, though the Cariennan might join in once they realized what was happening. And they would all die. The smart thing would be to let them get on with it while he headed in the opposite direction. The only trouble was that once these idiots let the Aiel know they were discovered, those Aiel might decide to do something fancy, like swinging around to take the strung-out fools in the flank. If that happened, there was no certainty that he would get clear.
"What the Lord Dragon wants you to do," he told them, "is to ride ahead slowly, just as if there wasn't an Aiel inside 100 miles. As soon as the pikes are through the gap, they'll form a hollow square, and you get yourselves inside it double quick."
"Inside?"
Melanreel protested. Angry mutters rose from the other young lords, except Estion, who looked thoughtful.
"There is no honor in hiding behind stinking—" "You bloody do it,"
Matt roared, reining Pips close to Melanreel's horse, "or if the bloody Aiel don't kill you, Rand will.
And whatever he leaves, I'll chop into sausage myself."
This was taking too long. The Aiel had to be wondering what they were talking about by now.
"With any luck, you will be set before the Aiel can hit you. If you have horse bows, use them. Otherwise, hold tight. You'll get your bloody charge, and you'll know when. But if you move too early—"
He could almost feel time running down. Setting the butt of his spear in his stirrup like a lance, he heeled Pips back down the column. When he glanced over his shoulder, Melanreel and the others were talking and peering after him. At least they were not herring up the valley. The commander of the pikemen proved to be a pale, slender Cariennan, half a head shorter than Matt, and mounted on a gray gelding that looked past ready for the pasture. Derrid had hard eyes, though, an oft-broken nose, and three white scars crisscrossing his face, one of them not very old. He took off his bell-shaped helmet while he talked with Matt. The front of his head was shaved. No lord, he. Maybe he had been part of the army before the Civil War started. Yes, his men knew how to form a hedgehog. He had not faced Aiel, but he had faced brigands and Andoran cavalry. There was an implication that he had fought other Kyrianen as well, for one of the houses contesting for the throne. Derrid sounded neither eager nor reluctant. He sounded like a man with a job of work to do. The column stepped off as Matt turned Pips's head the other way. They marched with a measured pace, and a quick look behind showed the tyrant's horses moving no faster. He let Pips go a little quicker than a walk, but not much. It seemed he could feel Aiel eyes on his back, feel them wondering what he had said, and where he was going now and why. "Just a messenger who's delivered his message and is going away. Nothing to worry about." He certainly hoped that was what the Aiel thought, but his shoulders did not untense until he was sure they could no longer see him. The Kyrianen were still waiting where he had left them. They still had their flankers out, too. Banners and Khan made a thicket where the lords had gathered, one in ten or better of the Kyrian's number. Most of them wore plain breastplates, and where there was gilt or silver work, it was battered, as though a drunken blacksmith had been at it. Some of their mounts made Derrid's look like Lan's warhorse. Could they even do what was needed? But the faces that turned to him were hard, the gazes harder. He was in the clear now, hidden from the Aiel. He could ride on, after telling this lot what was expected of them anyway. He had sent the others on into the Aiel trap. He could not simply abandon them. Talmanis of House Delovinda, his Khan three yellow stars on blue, and his banner a black fox, was even shorter than Derrid, and had 3 years on Matt at most. But he led these Kyrianen, although there were older men and even gray hair present. His eyes held as little expression as Derrid's, and he looked like a coiled whip. His armor and sword were utterly plain. Once he had told Matt his name, the man listened quietly while Matt laid out his plan, leaning a little out of the saddle to cut lines in the ground with the sword-bladed spear. The other Kyrianen lords gathered round on their horses, watching, but none so sharply as Talmanis. Talmanis studied the map he drew, and studied him from boots to hat, even his spear. When he was done, the fellow still did not speak, until Matt barked, "Well, I don't care whether you take it or leave it, but your friends will be hip-deep in Aiel and not much longer." "The Tyrans are no friends of mine, and Derrid is useful. Certainly not a friend." Dry chuckles ran through the onlooking lords at the suggestion. "But I will lead one half, if you lead the other." Talmanis pulled off one steel-backed gauntlet and put out his hand. But for a moment, Matt only stared at it. "Lead? Him? I'm a gambler, not a soldier. A lover." Memories of battles long gone spun through his head, but he forced them down. All he had to do was ride on. But then maybe Talmanis would leave Estion and Derrid and the rest to roast. On the spit Matt had hung them from. Even so, it was a surprise to him when he grasped the other's hand and said, "You just be there when you're supposed to be." For reply, Talmanis began calling off names in a quick voice. Lords and lordlings reined toward Matt, each followed by a bannerman and perhaps a dozen retainers, until he had 400 odd of the Kyrianen. Talmanis did not have much to say after, either. He just led the remainder west at a trot, trailing a faint cloud of dust. "Keep together," Matt told his half. "Charge when I say charge, run when I say run, and don't make any noise you don't have to." There was the creak of saddles and the thud of hooves as they followed him, of course, but at least they did not talk or ask questions. A last glimpse on the other bristle of bright banners in Khan, and then a twist in the shallow valley hid them. How had he gotten into this? It had all started so simply. Just give warning and go. Each step after it seemed so small, so necessary. and now he had waded waist-deep into the mud, and no choice but to keep on. He hoped Talmanis meant to show up. The man had not even asked who he was. The hill valley twisted and forked as he angled north, but he had a good sense of direction. For instance, he knew exactly which way lay south and safety, and it was not the way he was heading. Dark clouds were forming up there toward the city, the first he had seen so thick in a long time. Rain would break the drought, good for the farmers, if any remained, and settle the dust, good for horsemen, so they did not announce themselves too early. Maybe if it rained, the Aiel would give up and go home. The wind was beginning to pick up, too, bringing a little cool, for a wonder. The sound of fighting drifted over the crests, men shouting, men screaming. It had begun. Matt turned pips, raised his spear, and swung it right and left. He was almost surprised when the Kyrianen formed into one long line to either side of him, facing upslope. The gesture had been instinctive from another time and place, but then these men had seen fighting. He started pips up through the scattered trees at a slow walk, and they kept pace to the quiet jangle of bridles. His first thought on reaching the height was relief at seeing Talmanis and his men coming into sight on the crest across from him. His second was to curse. Darid had formed the hedgehog, spiny thickets of pikes four deep interspersed with bowmen to make a large hollow square. Long pikes made it difficult for the Shido to get close, however they rushed in, and the archers and crossbowmen were exchanging shots hot and fast with the Aiel. Men were falling on both sides, but the pikes simply closed in when one of their number went down, making the square tighter. Of course, the Shido did not appear to slacken their assault either. The defenders were dismounted in the center, and maybe half the Tyran lords with their retainers. Half. That was what made him want to curse. The rest dashed about among the Aiel, slashing and stabbing with sword and lance in knots of 5 or 10, or alone. Dozens of riderless horses told how well they were doing. Milenril was off with only his bannerman, laying about with his blade. Two Aiel darted in to neatly hamstring the lordling's horse. It fell, head flailing. Matt was sure it screamed, but the din swallowed it. And then Melonreal vanished behind cotton sore-clad figures, spears stabbing. The bannerman lasted a moment longer. Good riddance, Matt thought grimly. Standing in his stirrups, he raised the sword-bladed spear high, then swept it forward, shouting,
Los! Los Cavadrin!
He would have had the words back if he could, and not because they were old tongue. It was a boiling cauldron down in the valley. But whether or not any of the Kyrianen understood a command of horsemen forward in the old tongue, they understood the gesture, especially when he dropped back into his saddle and dug in his heels. Not that he really wanted to, but he could not see any choice now. He had put those men down there. Some might have gotten away if he had told them to turn and run. And he just did not have a choice. Banners and con waving, the Kyrianen charged downhill with him, shouting battle cries. In imitation of him, no doubt, though what he was shouting was blood and bloody ashes. Across the valley, Talmanis raced down just as hard. Sure that they had all the wetlanders penned, the Shido never saw the others until crashed into from behind on both sides. It was then that the lightning began to fall, and after that, things really got hairy. Chapter 44 The Lesser Sadness. Rand's shirt clung to him with the sweat of effort, but he kept his coat on for protection from the wind gusting toward Kyrian. The sun had at least another hour to reach its noonday peak, yet already he felt as if he had run all morning and been beaten with a club at the finish. Wrapped in the void, he was only distantly aware of the weariness, dimly perceiving the ache in his arms and shoulders, in the small of his back, a throb around the tender scar in his side. That he was aware of them at all told the story. With the power in him, he could make out individual leaves on the trees at 100 paces. But whatever happened to him physically should have been as if it were happening to someone else.
He had long since taken to drawing on Saidin, threw the Ungrial in his pocket, the stone carving of the fat little man. Even so, working the power was a strain now, weaving it at this distance of miles. But only the rancid threads streaking what he drew kept him from pulling more, from trying to pull it all to him. The power was that sweet, taint or no. After hours of channeling without rest, he was that tired. At the same time, he had to fight Saidin itself harder, to put more of his strength into keeping it from burning him to ash where he stood, from burning his mind to ash. It was ever more difficult to hold off Saidin's destruction, more difficult to resist the desire to draw more difficult to handle what he did draw. A nasty downward spiral, and hours to go before the battle was decided. Wiping sweat from his eyes, he gripped the platform's rough railing. He was near the brink, yet he was stronger than Egwene or Avienda. The Aiel woman was standing, peering off toward Kyrian and the storm clouds, occasionally bending to stare through the long looking glass. Egwene sat cross-legged, leaning back against an upright still covered in gray bark, her eyes closed. They both looked as worked out as he felt. Before he could do anything, not that he knew what, he had no skill at healing, Egwene's eyes opened, and she stood, exchanging a few quiet words with Avienda that the wind snatched away from even his Saidin-enhanced hearing. Then Avienda sat down in Egwene's place and let her head fall back against the upright. The black clouds around the city continued to stab lightning, but they were wild forks far more often than single lances now. So they were taking turns, giving each other a rest. It would have been nice to have someone do that with him, but he did not regret telling Asmodian to stay in his tent. He would not have trusted him to channel, especially not now. Who could say what he would have done when he saw Rand weakened as he was? Staggering slightly, Rand pulled his looking-glass around to study the hills outside the city. Life was certainly visible there now, and death. Wherever he looked, there was fighting. Aiel against Aiel, 1,000 here, 5,000 there, swarming over the treeless hills and too closely meshed for him to do anything. He could not find the column of horse and pike. 3 times he had seen them, once fighting twice their number of Aiel. He was certain they were still out there. Small hope that Melonreal had decided to obey his orders at this late juncture. Choosing the man just because he had the grace to be embarrassed by Wyrmann's behavior had been a mistake. But there had been little time to make a choice, and he had had to get rid of Wyrmann. Nothing to be done about it now. Maybe one of the Kyrianen could be put in command. If even his direct order would make the Tyrans follow a Kyrianen. A milling mass right at the city's high gray wall caught his eye. Tall, iron-bound gates stood open. Aiel battling horsemen and spearmen almost in the open, while folk tried to close the gates, tried and failed because of the press of bodies. Horses with empty saddles and armored men unmoving on the ground half a mile from the gate marked where the sortie had been driven back. Arrows rained down from the walls and head-sized chunks of rubble, even occasional spears slashing down, with enough force to spit 2 men or 3, though he still could not see from where exactly. But the Aiel were going over their dead, ever closer to forcing their way in. A quick scan showed him 2 more columns of Aiel trotting toward the gates, perhaps 3,000 all told. He did not doubt that they were Culloden's as well. He was aware of grinding his teeth. If the Shido got inside Kyrian, he would never drive them north. He would have to dig them out street by street. The cost in lives would dwarf the number of those already dead, and the city itself would end a ruin like Ironrod, if not Tyen. Kyrianen and Shido were mingled like ants in a bowl, but he had to do something. Taking a deep breath, he channeled. The 2 women had set the conditions, bringing the storm clouds. He did not need to be able to see their weavings to take advantage of them. Stark, silver-blue lightning struck into the Aiel once, twice, again, as fast as a man could clap. Rand jerked his head up, blinking away the burning lines that still seemed to cross his sight, and when he looked through the long tube again, Shido lay like cut barley all around where the bolts had fallen. Men and horses thrashed on the ground closer to the gates, too,
and some did not move at all. But the uninjured were dragging the injured, and the gates were beginning to close. How many won't make it back inside? How many of my own did I kill? The cold truth was that it did not matter. It had had to be done, and it was done. And well it was. Distantly he felt his knees wobbling. He would have to pace himself if he was to last the rest of the day. No more laying about him everywhere. He had to spot where he was particularly needed, where he could make a... The storm clouds were massed only over the city and the hills to the south, but that did not stop lightning from slashing out of the clear, cloudless sky above the tower, flashing down into the gathered maidens below with a deafening crack. Hair lifting with the tingle in the air, Rand stared. He could feel that bolt in another way, feel the weaving of Sidene that had made it. So Asmodean was tempted, even back in the tents. There was no time for thought, though. Like rapid beats on a giant drum, bolt followed bolt, marching through the maidens until the last struck the base of the tower in an explosion of splinters the size of arms and legs. As the tower slowly began to slant over, Rand threw himself at Egwene and Avienda. Somehow he managed to scoop them both into one arm, then wrap the other around an upright on what was now the upslope side of the platform. They stared at him wide-eyed, mouths coming open, but there was no more time for speaking than for thinking. The shattered log tower toppled, crashing through the branches of the trees. For an instant, he believed they might cushion the fall. With a snap, the upright he clung to broke off. The ground came up and knocked all the breath out of him, a heartbeat before the women came down on top of him. Darkness rolled in. He regained consciousness slowly. Hearing returned first.
"Have dug us up like a boulder and sent us rolling downhill in the night."
It was Avienda's voice, low, as if she spoke for her own ears. There was something moving on his face.
"You have taken away what we are, what we were. You must give us something in return, something to be. We need you."
The moving thing slowed, touched more softly.
"I need you. Not for myself, you will understand. For Elaine. What is between her and me now is between her and me. But I will hand you to her. I will. If you die, I will carry your corpse to her. If you die..."
His eyes popped open, and for a moment they stared at each other, almost nose to nose. Her hair was all in disarray, her headscarf gone, and a purple lump marred her cheek. She straightened jerkily, folding a damp cloth stained with blood, and began dabbing at his forehead with considerably more force than before.
"I have no intention of dying," he told her, though in truth he was not sure of that at all.
The Void and Sidene were gone, of course. Just thinking of losing them as he had made him shiver. It was pure luck that Sidene had not scoured his mind blank in that last instant. Just thinking of seizing the source again made him groan. Without the Void for buffer, he felt every ache, every bruise and scrape to the fullest. He was so tired he could have dropped off to sleep at once if he had not hurt so much. As well he did hurt then, because he surely could not sleep. Not for a long time yet. Sliding a hand beneath his coat, he touched his side, then surreptitiously wiped the blood off his fingers onto his shirt before bringing the hand out again. No wonder that a fall like that had broken open the half-healed, never-healed wound. He did not seem to be bleeding too badly, but if the maiden saw it, or Egwene, or even Avienda, he might have a fight to keep from being hauled off to Moraine for healing. He had too much to do yet for that. Being healed on top of everything else would act on him like a cudgel to the temple. And besides, there must be far worse hurt than what he suffered for her to deal with. Grimacing, suppressing another groan, he got to his feet with only a little help from Avienda, and promptly forgot about his injuries. Sulin sat on the ground nearby, with Egwene bandaging a bloody split in her scalp and muttering fiercely at herself because she did not know how to heal. But the white-haired maiden was not the only casualty, and not the worst by far. Everywhere, cotton sore-clad women were covering the dead with blankets and tending those who had merely been burned, if merely could be used for lightning burns. Except for Egwene's grumbling, the hilltop lay in near silence.
even the injured women quiet, save for hoarse breathing.
The log tower, all but unrecognizable now, had not spared the maidens in its fall, breaking arms and legs, tearing open gashes. He watched as a blanket was laid over the face of a maiden with red-gold hair, almost the shade of Elaine's, head twisted at an unnatural angle and glazed eyes staring. Jolene. One of those who first crossed the dragon wall to search for he who comes with the dawn. She had gone to the Stone of Tyr for him, and now she was dead for him.
Oh, you've done well at keeping the maidens from harm, he thought bitterly. Very well indeed.
He could still feel the lightning, or rather the residue of its making. Almost like the afterimage burned into his eyes earlier, he could trace the weave, though it was fading. To his surprise, it led west, not back toward the tents.
Not Asmodean, then. Samael. He was sure of it.
Samael had sent that attack in the Jangai. Samael was behind the pirates and the raids in Tyr. And Samael had done this. His lips peeled back in a snarl, and his voice was a harsh whisper.
Samael!
He did not realize he had taken a step until Avienda seized his arm. A moment later, Egwene had the other, the pair of them clinging to him as if they meant to root him to the spot.
Do not be a complete woolhead, Egwene said, giving a start at his glare but not letting go.
She had redone the brown scarf around her head, but combing with her fingers had not put her hair back in order, and dust still covered her blouse and skirt.
Whoever did this, why do you think he waited so long, until you must be tired?
Because if he missed killing you, and you went after him, you would be easy meat. You can barely stand on your own. Avienda was no readier to let go, meeting his stare with a flat one of her own.
You are needed here, Randolthor. Here, Karakarn. Does your honor lie with killing this man, or here with those you have brought to this land?
A young Aielman came running up through the maidens, shufa around his shoulders, spears and buckler swinging easily. If he thought it odd to find two women holding Rand between them, he gave no hint of it. He eyed the shattered remnants of the tower and the dead and wounded with a slight curiosity, as though wondering how it might have happened and where the enemy dead might be. Grounding his spear points in front of Rand, he said,
I am Siren, of the Sharara sept of the Tomanel.
I see you, Siren, Rand replied just as formally, not easy with a pair of women holding him as if they thought he might run.
Han of the Tomanel sends word to the Karkarn. The clans to the east are moving toward each other, all four. He means to join with Derek, and he has sent to Aram to join them.
Rand drew a measured breath and hoped the women thought his grimace was for the news. His side burned, and he could feel blood spreading slowly down his shirt. So there would be nothing to force Cúlidan north when the Shido broke. If they broke, they had given no evidence of it yet that he had seen. Why were the Miagoma and the others joining together? If they meant to come against him, they were only giving warning. But if they meant to come against him, Han and Derek and Aram would be outnumbered. And if the Shido held long enough, and the four clans broke through... Across the wooded hills he could see that it had begun to rain over the city, now that Egwene and Avienda were not holding the clouds. That would hamper both sides. Unless the women were in better shape than they looked, they might be unable to regain control from this distance. Tell Han to do what he must to keep them off our backs. Young as he was about Rand's age, come to that. Siren raised an eyebrow in surprise. Of course. Han would not do differently, and Siren knew it. He waited only long enough to make certain that Rand had no further message. Then he was off and running downhill just as fast as he had come. No doubt he hoped to get back without missing any more of the fighting than he had to. For that matter, it might already have begun there to the east.
I need someone to fetch Jaden, Rand said as soon as Siren had dashed off.
If he tried to walk that far, he really would need the women to hold him up. The two of them looked nothing alike, yet they managed practically identical suspicion. Those frowns must have been one of the things every girl was taught by her mother.
I'm not going after Samael.
Not yet.
I have to get closer to the city, though.
He nodded to the fallen tower. That was the only gesture available with them hanging on.
Master Torvir might be able to salvage the lenses from the looking glasses, but there were not three logs of the tower unbroken. No more observing everything from on high today.
Egwene was plainly uncertain, but Avienda barely paused before asking a young maiden to go to the Gaishine. To fetch mist, too, which he had not counted on. Egwene began brushing herself off, muttering under her breath at the dust, and Avienda had found an ivory comb and another scarf somewhere. Despite the fall, somehow they already looked considerably less disheveled than he. Weariness still marked their faces, but as long as they could channel at all, they would be useful. That gave him pause. Did he ever think of anyone now except as how useful they were?
He should be able to keep them as safe as they had been atop the tower. Not that the tower had been very safe, as it turned out. But this time he would manage things better.
Sulin stood as he approached, a pale cap of Algoda bandage covering the top of her head, her hair a white fringe below.
"I'm moving nearer the city," he told her, "where I can see what is happening, and maybe do something about it. Everyone who is injured is to remain here, along with enough others to protect them if need be. Make it a strong guard, Sulin. I only need a handful with me, and it's poor repayment for the honor the maidens have shown me if I let their wounded